Good Monday to you. Thanks so much for tuning in to another edition of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by our friends at Nosler. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Coming to you today, once again, from a beautiful Farmville, Virginia, site of the 2016 vice presidential debate. Just talking about that earlier today, wondering what this small town is going to be like in October when the vice presidential debate is held. Guessing that, you know, anywhere there are cameras, there are, I guess, likely to be protesters and activists. So we'll probably see a ton of that descend on the town for a couple of days. Seems to be the case during the election season so far. Now, we've got a great show for you today. Coming up in just a little bit, West Virginia delegate Sarah Blair is going to join us on the program. One of those responsible for shepherding permitless carry through the West Virginia legislature, including a override of the governor's veto. And it'll be early June when permitless carry takes effect. Also, some changes to the concealed carry law in the state of West Virginia. Concealed carry not going away in the state. But there are some changes, and again, we'll talk about it with Delegate Sarah Blair. Dave Adams of the Virginia Shooting Sports Association on the now-finished Virginia legislative session. It was a busy one for gun owners. We'll go over everything with Dave later on in the hour. Next hour, Michael Graham, host of the Michael Graham Show in Atlanta, Georgia. I'm curious to know if Michael has been talking about it, and if listeners there at News Radio 106.7 are talking a lot about campus carry, which is now on the desk of Governor Nathan Deal there in the state of Georgia. Antonia Okafor with Students for Concealed Carry. Actually, no, I think this was Jen Jakes who had shared this on Twitter, another professor complaining that students are just too immature, they're too irresponsible, and this is why campus carry is a horrible idea, not thinking this argument all the way through, because again, the people that we're talking about are concealed carry holders. They're already carrying off campus and they're not causing any problems. So what is it about setting foot on a college campus that would make a concealed carry holder turn into an irresponsible buffoon? I think the professors are really opposed to carrying for self-defense. They may also think that their students are by and large, morons who aren't responsible enough to handle car keys, much less a firearm. But I got to tell you, I don't think it's a very good argument. Jed Babin from the American Spectator on President Obama's foreign policy in Libya. The headline of this piece, Obama's Libya Bleep Show, which he says pretty much sums up Obama's foreign policy legacy. Seems to be. We saw another violent weekend around the world. Reports today that the Kurds managed to get a hold of an American-born ISIS fighter from right here in Virginia. As a matter of fact, Alexandria, Virginia. Is that right, Cameron?
Yes, we got the we won the ISIS lottery somehow. Of all the places this guy could have been from, it's all these stories here in town. That the man was from Alexandria. And once again, I must credit the Kurds, who don't get hardly any credit. The Kurds caught this guy, thankfully. But yes, right here in Alexandria. So you are safely ensconced in Farmville. We have there's been a lot of, if you recall, a lot of ISIS types from this area, if not from this town of Alexandria. If anyone wants to Google and look back and check my work, it's quite frightening. And of course, we don't have a market, a monopoly on it, but there's a lot here, and it's very frightening.
There was the 17-year-old down in Prince William County, yep, who was sentenced for ISIS recruiting
in high school.
Northern Virginia's. Yeah, right, exactly. And this guy, I think, pretty young. Apparently, from what I understand, he was trying to leave ISIS. Apparently, after 2 months of hanging out with ISIS, apparently he didn't want to be there anymore. So the story was that he was trying to get to Turkey. He ended up walking into the Kurdish lines, surrendered to them, and it'll be interesting to see what exactly happens to this individual going forward now, right? I, President Obama wants to treat terrorism like a crime, so maybe Cameron Hill end up in Alexandria Municipal Court. He'll pay a fine.
Right, and that's the thing. It's like it's. I don't know. I struggle with this too because you see a lot of this in the UK, where you know, oh my God, I had no idea how bad ISIS would be. Let me come home, and the prevailing attitude is fine. They can come home, but in my mind, if you leave your country to fight against your country and others, I don't know how you get your citizenship back. And it seems to be I'm in the minority when it comes to the people in power, because people think you should just allow people back in the country, especially in the UK, and I know here too. And I don't know how you feel about it, but I think once you are a sworn enemy, and I think if you join ISIS, you're a sworn enemy of the United States, you're done. I don't know how you get, you can have the discussion whether you put them somewhere else, you death penalty, whatever. I don't, regardless. But how they get their citizenship back is beyond me.
Well, they're not going to go to Guantanamo Bay, not under this administration. So, I don't know how I feel. Certainly, there shouldn't be just you made a mistake. Well, come on, everything's all forgiven. I think that it's a pretty big mistake to make. And particularly, as you say, when you're talking about joining a group which has pledged to bring death and destruction to the United States, how can you be sure that individual has really had a change of heart? I don't know what the answer is, honestly, but guess we'll find out what the Obama administration thinks the answer is here before long. Tim Lee with the Center for Individual Freedom coming up in Hour 3. Also, John Cardillo, host of the John Cardillo Show, former New York police officer. We're going to talk about attacks on police officers over the weekend. Again, one in the D.C. suburbs where authorities are now holding three brothers in an attack on a police department where one police officer was killed. And authorities are saying that this was apparently they believe that this was a planned attack, that these individuals had planned to die in a shootout with police officers there in Prince George's County, Maryland. So we'll talk with John Cardillo about that. Also, news out of New York, a survey of New York police officers showing that most of them are deeply unhappy with the work environment. They are deeply unhappy being a police officer in New York City right now. And the reasons why, I think, are wide and varied. But again, we'll talk about it with John Cardillo coming up in Hour 3. Also coming up in Hour 3, our hero of the day. We also have an update on a previous hero of the day, a deal of the day, good guy of the day as well. We'll be covering all of the day's top Second Amendment stories throughout the program. CNN reporting President Barack Obama narrowing the list of choices of who to nominate to fill the Supreme Court vacancy, with three sitting federal appellate judges topping the list. Three sources familiar with the process confirmed to CNN. Now, Mitch McConnell has already said we're not going to be holding any hearings, but that's not going to stop President Obama from putting forth a name and then trying to make as much political hay as possible out of those recalcitrant Republicans refusing to hold hearings. One of these sources told CNN that the vetting process is continuing. All of these sources caution that this is an ongoing process and don't preclude a last-minute surprise. But the three said to be at the top of the list are Srinivasan, who is on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia, Paul Watford, out of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, Merrick Garland, who is the Chief Judge for the D.C. Appeals Circuit. The announcement could come as early as next week, one of these sources told CNN. Of course, we have seen other sources tell other media outlets that the announcement could come as early as this week. So who knows? See, this is the problem. I think, you know, President Obama wants to time this for the utmost political attention. And the news cycle seems to be consumed by other issues right now. I don't think the media has much interest in covering President Obama naming somebody to be his nominee to the Supreme Court when there are so many other big political stories that they can be covering, right? So we'll see. It may be after the, certainly it wouldn't be tomorrow. I think the March 15th primaries will come and go without the president announcing who he would like to see on the Supreme Court. But in the next few days, expect to see a name released. Now, Hillary Clinton, who, of course, would like to name a number of Supreme Court nominees as well, and if she becomes president, she will likely get the chance to do so. At a town hall meeting, she was asked about what can be done to stop gang-related gun violence. This was last night on the CNN Democrat town hall in Ohio. AWR Hawkins writing that she was responding to comments from questioner Vashita Johnson, who talked about a 7-year-old boy being killed and his 5-year-old and 4-year-old siblings being wounded in a gang-related attack. Dr. Hawkins says the questioner was clear. This incident was actually a gang-related retaliation shooting. She also mentioned a shooting in which another 5-year-old was shot while lying in bed and then asked, what programs would you implement in poverty-stricken communities in this country as in an effort to decrease this type of violence? And Hillary Clinton said she wants comprehensive background checks. We need background checks. And she said gun makers have to be held, quote, accountable for the use of their products. So the standard Clinton gun control reply. Meanwhile, in Chicago, we told you about the guy who was arrested, second individual arrested in the murder of Tyshawn Lee. This 9-year-old boy lured into an alley, assassinated, according to authorities. The 22-year-old charged in this murder, a guy with already a lengthy criminal history to his name, who served less than 50% of a sentence for armed robbery and was released on probation just a few months ago. We learned over the weekend that the father of Tyshawn Lee has been arrested and charged with shooting the girlfriend of one of the men held in the killing of his son. Law enforcement sources, according to the Chicago Tribune, identified the woman as the girlfriend of Corey Morgan, who is in custody awaiting trial in Tyshawn's killing, the second the first suspect who was arrested. About 3 weeks before Tyshawn Lee was lured from a Dawes Park play lot and executed, Morgan's brother was killed and mother wounded as part of a long-running gang feud, police have said. In the latest shooting, Morgan's girlfriend suffered a graze wound while the two men were taken to Advocate Christ Medical Center in Oakland with non-life-threatening injuries. The suspect here, Pierre Stokes, accused not just of shooting the girlfriend of one of the men, but also of two other men. He's been charged with 3 counts of aggravated battery with a firearm and 1 count of unlawful use of a weapon by a felon. He's 25. Statement issued by police spokesman Anthony Guglielmi said, Mr. Stokes, who was involved in a gang lifestyle, ultimately suffered an unspeakable loss with the calculated execution of his son. Despite this, he continued to engage in the same gang activity that started this initial cycle of violence. CPD will continue our efforts to disrupt gang activity in Chicago and at the same time work with our community partners through our gang call-ins to try to urge gang members to see the casualties of that lifestyle and offer alternatives like job placement, training, and education options. Hillary Clinton was asked a real question. What are you going to do to stop this type of violence? And what she said was, we're going to put another gun law on the books. You know, like the boatload of them that they have on the books in Chicago. Like the ones that they put on the books in Baltimore, Maryland in 2013 and saw a homicide spike to a 20-year high in 2015. Like the gun laws that they have on the books in Los Angeles, and we're seeing violent crime go up there. The gun laws we have on the books again in Chicago, where homicides are up nearly 100% over last year. We're going to put another gun law on the books. What Hillary Clinton didn't want to acknowledge, couldn't acknowledge, didn't know, is the fact that we're talking about individuals who are responsible for a disproportionate amount of violent crime. Small number of the community. Big problem in terms of violent crime. And as we've talked about on this program before, if you can keep your criminal activity off the front page of the newspaper, if your crimes do not rise to the level that they lead the nightly news one night, you can pretty much get away with this. You might get arrested. You might get charged. You're probably going to get offered a plea bargain. You're probably not going to have to do the time that the law says you should serve. You'll get a day off likely for every day behind bars that you don't assault a prison guard. And soon you'll be back out onto the streets. And that's if you get sentenced to prison at all. Many times you won't. You'll just get probation. Many times you'll get arrested. You will be charged, but the prosecution will never actually proceed. They'll just sort of be hanging over your head, and you'll be told, hey, if you screw up again, we're going to bring this charge, and that may or may not happen. And that is the norm. That is the system right now. Again, unless or until you commit a crime so heinous that it does make the front page of the paper, that it does lead the nightly news, and then all of a sudden the system will pay a little bit more attention to you. I think what that woman was asking Hillary Clinton is, what do we do? What are you going to do to make sure that people like Tyshawn Lee's murderer isn't out on the street to commit these crimes when we know that he's a violent offender, or Mr. Stokes? What are we going to do? What are you going to do to keep these violent criminals from committing these violent crimes? And Hillary's answer was, well, we're going to have another gun law. Just like the ones that didn't stop Mr. Stokes. Just like the ones that didn't stop Tyshawn Lee's murderers. Just like the ones that didn't stop the more than 100 homicides we've had in Washington or in Chicago this year. We're going to again talk about this with John Cardillo. About some of the things that can be done. Some of the things that really can be done. As opposed to calling for another gun control law. But that's coming up again in Hour 3. When we come back after a quick timeout here on this edition of NRA News Cam and Company. State Delegate Sarah Blair from West Virginia on permitless carry in the Mountaineer State. Stick around. We'll be right back with much more NRA News Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, right after this.
All right, so we're out walking around here, and I ran into Glenn Klecker with Klecker Knives. All right, tell me, what is Klecker Knives? What are you all about?
Klecker Knives is basically about innovation, family values, good old whatever I can do to help people enjoy their time in the outdoors and bring their family doing it.
All right, and you got some really neat stuff, so show us some of your products here.
Well, the first one I want to show here is the trigger. This is basically like a knife kit. We designed a wooden one that we released before with my son Nathan. Mm-hmm. This is the follow-on version. The idea behind this is it's a bunch of parts you can build together like a model car or model plane.
Cool.
You put the pieces together and it's a full locking knife, but it's not sharp. It's guaranteed to cut butter, though.
That's cool. What else you got?
So then the next one is, this is the Cordovan. This is our most popular folding knife. And the idea behind the Cordovan is that it has a locking system that I have a patent on. So this is called the Klecker Lock. Then over here we have a new one for this year is called the Abiqua. Comes built with a Kydex sheath. The idea behind the Abiqua is that people want really good, comfortable hunting knife. Fits good in the hand. But the benefit of the Abiqua is that it has a built-in gut hook right into the handle.
Oh, nice.
So it gives you a nice full three-finger gut hook. So you're not going to lose it. So this is called the Klax. It stands for the Klecker Axe System. The idea behind this is how can you go to the woods, have the tools you need, and not have to carry all the bulk that you would normally.
Okay.
So on a regular axe, you're going to carry around an axe that's got a handle. It's about this size.
Right.
But with this, you carry around just this. When you need to, you can take this, use it as a hand tool, carve yourself a handle, you cut a split in it, and then just flip the clamps out, slide it down over the handle, tighten it up, whack it on the log a few times, seat the clamps, and then you can start going to town.
Awesome. How can folks get more information about Klecker Knives?
So you can find us on the web at kleckerknives.com.
All right. Glenn Klecker with Klecker Knives. Save the best for last. Dennis, one. This is one for you for Dennis's Auto. There you go, buddy. Thanks for being on NRA News. We appreciate it.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Speaking with Jacqueline Kelly with Armed in Heels. Jacqueline, welcome to NRA News. How are you?
I'm doing so great. How are you doing?
I'm doing so well and better now that you're here, by the way.
Oh, thank you so much.
You light up the set.
Oh, so I'm glad to hear.
Tell us, what is Armed in Heels all about?
So Armed in Heels is an online retailer, and our goal is to support women who feel empowered and to feel empowered as they enter the shooting community. My husband and I started this company when he introduced me to firearms. I cried. I was terrified. I tried to go enter the industry to get more information and to engage and learn, but it was really intimidating for me. And so what we did is create Armed in Heels to support the working woman, the empowered women, the wife, the mother that wants to get engaged in a safe way.
Okay, so you said you went and tried it. You cried, you were terrified. Was that before or after you shot?
I think he took it out of the case. I cried, and then he put it away. And
I see.
It
okay.
maybe took 2 years to get the guts
really?
To do it again. And I don't want women to have that experience.
No, no way.
No, so my goal is to make sure that they have an opportunity to get into the industry in a way that really makes them feel empowered and supported and helps establish their identity further.
I think that's an awesome idea. So, Jacqueline, how do you do this?
So what we do is we very carefully target lots of products that are actually made for women. That does not mean pink. That does not mean colors. That means if I see tack pants, they better fit my curves and they better help me conceal the way I want. And holsters, the same thing. So we really go out, pressure the manufacturers, and get those products to our women so that they can have them and integrate them with part of their lifestyle.
Awesome. You seem to have it figured out. This, I love your approach. I love your idea.
Great.
So how can people get more information about Armed in Heels?
So we can go onto our website, which is www.armedinheels.com.
Right.
You can also visit us on Facebook at Armed in Heels. And we're certainly looking to bring a good voice out there, so we hope we can get lots of women to engage.
Keep up the good work. Jacqueline Kelly with Armed in Heels, thanks for what you're doing, and thanks for being on NRA News. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you so much.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. Dave Adams of the Virginia Shooting Sports Association coming up a little bit later on in the hour talking legislative roundup. Virginia session is over. Unfortunately, we had a permitless carry bill in Virginia, but it did not make it to Governor Terry McAuliffe's desk. I have no idea what the governor would have done had it got there, but I do know I am a little jealous of our neighbors and our sister state of West Virginia. State Delegate Sarah Blair is with us on the program right now. Delegate, how are you doing today?
I'm good.
So it's good having you back on the program, and congratulations on permitless carry becoming the law of the land in West Virginia.
Well, thank you very much. We're pretty excited right now.
As you should be. So we had you on the program, I think, when the bill was before the Senate. Just like in the House, Bill enjoyed a lot of support there. It seems like most folks in West Virginia actually support the bill, with the exception of your governor, perhaps.
Yes. There was a poll that was put out that said 84% of West Virginians didn't support the bill, but that was a complete lie. I've had thousands of emails from West Virginians all over the state wholeheartedly in support of this legislation.
And what are they telling you, Delegate?
I've heard so many different things. I've had a lot of personal stories. A lot of people have said, you know, thank you. The $100 permitting fee is to keep the poor from having guns. That's all it's doing. It's saying that, you know, a single mom with three kids can't arm herself because she can't spend that $100 on a permit when she could be spending it to pack their lunches. And so I've had personal comments like that. I've had a gentleman who said, because this one does put in a provisional license for 18 to 20-year-olds, allowing them to now conceal carry if they go through the training class. And he told me that back before that age group was not allowed to carry, that his daughter was a student at West Virginia University, where I am, so I was very touched by this, but that she was walking home one night when a potential rapist grabbed her, and she was able to use her firearm to protect herself. And so I've just had so many heartwarming stories of people who really genuinely believe that this is going to make our state better.
That is fantastic. And as you say, you know, the reasons why people are supporting this are varied, but you know, you know this probably better than I do, Delegate. West Virginia, you all have been pretty hard hit by the Obama economy over the last 7 years, and you know, it is a real concern for people. $100 a year is, you know, that's not a small sum when you are living paycheck to paycheck or trying to live paycheck to paycheck. The idea that, you know, you would have to fork over a fee to exercise a government right, or excuse me, not a government right, an individual right, I imagine it does rub some people the wrong way.
Yep, absolutely. So we're ecstatic to have this through. We actually just ended our 60-day session Saturday night at midnight. So we got this through, and we're just so proud that we were able to override a governor's veto.
That is fantastic. And as you say, most of what you're hearing is support. What would you say to people who say, oh, Delegate Blair, now we've got to have people without any training whatsoever or running around. They're going to be toting guns. It's going to be wild West Virginia, not just West Virginia.
Well, one of my favorite arguments is we have a lot of bordering states in West Virginia. One of our bordering states is Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania, in order to get a concealed carry permit, doesn't have a training requirement, and we have reciprocity with Pennsylvania. So there are people coming over, crossing into the state all the time that don't have official state-mandated training. Now, they might have training. I'm sure they have training, but it's not mandated training. And we don't have any cases of the Wild West, and you're not seeing that in Pennsylvania either. And so to say that any of us who voted for this are pro-crime or, you know, we're turning back great legislation and years of it, that's all – it's just false. And I think time will prove that we're not going to see any more accidents. We're not going to see any more crime. This bill only applies to law-abiding citizens that are going to be able to protect themselves.
I think it was one of your colleagues in the state Senate who said that he thought he could hear drug traffickers in Detroit cheering because now the drug traffickers would be able to legally carry firearms while they're illegally transporting illegal drugs in West Virginia. I mean, I is that the type of rhetoric that you were hearing from the opponents of this legislation?
Absolutely. And it's unfortunate and it's sad because at the end of the day, I mean, we do have a major drug problem in West Virginia, the same as the rest of the country, sadly. But we do have a lot of out-of-staters coming in. But at the end of the day, drug trafficking is a crime. And we've worked very extensively to make sure that, you know, people who are bringing in drugs from out of state are punished accordingly. And that has nothing to do with what they're carrying, whether and more than likely in a lot of these cases, they're already not on the list who's allowed to carry. And anyone who is
if you're carrying a firearm while you're transporting drugs, I'm guessing that would be a sentence enhancement.
Yeah.
Right? I'm guessing you're going to be going away for a longer period of time.
Yeah. Like I said before, that more than likely they're already on the list of no carry. And anybody who has, say, a felony charge is already not allowed to carry a weapon. And this bill does not change that whatsoever. And so it's a lot of lawyer speak trying to convince other people that this bill does something that it doesn't do.
Talking again with State Delegate Sarah Blair from West Virginia. So when does the bill go into effect, Delegate?
90 days after passage, which I believe was February 21st. So we tell people around the 1st of June is when they can start.
All right. And what will the law be for non-residents in West Virginia? If I wanted to go to West Virginia, I have my concealed carry license in Virginia, but could I carry without a license?
Yes. Anyone over the age of 21 is allowed to conceal carry without a permit in West Virginia.
All right. Well, listen, Delegate Blair, I really appreciate you coming on the program. It's always a pleasure talking with you, and hope we get a chance to do this again. Maybe around the 1st of June we can have you back on the program.
Absolutely. I would love that.
All right. Thanks so much.
Yep. Thanks for having me on.
You bet. Delegate Sarah Blair from West Virginia, the youngest legislator in America. Talking permitless carry in West Virginia. Yeah, that really was a dumb argument. No, I could hear the drug traffickers cheering there in Detroit. Really? What would they be cheering about? Because they're still breaking the law. And they're going to continue to break the law if they're trafficking drugs into West Virginia. So I'm guessing they're not really cheering about that. Again, I'm guessing they're not really paying much attention because they've already decided to operate outside of the boundaries of the law. But if that's the best argument you got, I guess, you know, you're going to use it. It's just kind of sad that that's the best argument they have, right? All right, still to come on the program, Dave Adams from the Virginia Shooting Sports Association. Also, next hour, talking with Michael Graham about campus carry in Georgia, where more professors are talking about how immature and irresponsible college students are. There's no way that campus carry is ever going to work. There's no way that these students can handle that responsibility. In unrelated news, West Virginia has won its fourth consecutive NCAA rifle championship. Yeah, how about that? Oh, do you see how we tied those two stories? West Virginia and then, interesting. Fourth straight year, the West Virginia rifle team coming in first place at the 2016 NCAA championships, a team score 47-03. The championships held in Akron, Ohio over the weekend. West Virginia captured the NCAA small bore and air rifle team titles for only the second time under a 10-year coach, John Hammond. First time that happened back in 2014. Jenny Thrasher of West Virginia University, an 18-year-old freshman, was responsible and spot on enough to win the NCAA air rifle title. She shot a team best 5.93 in the open relay. She becomes the second Mountaineer ever and the first since Petra Zublazing back in 2013 to sweep the NCAA titles. Wow. A West Virginia University female shooter has now won three of the last four NCAA air rifle titles. Not bad, I got to tell you, for a sport that was downgraded by the university a few years ago. They wanted to take this team from a varsity level, you know, NCAA a sport down to the club level. And it was the boosters, it was the supporters of the rifle team that in large part helped save the program. And here they are now, fourth consecutive NCAA title. You've got some of the best shooters in the nation. Coach Hammond said Jenny had an amazing year as a staff. He said we knew that she was capable of this. Her commitment to her process has been amazing. She is such a hard worker, and she deserves everything that she has earned. Jenny Thrasher, by the way, told the NCAA, feels amazing. She said, I'm so happy to be here. I'm so happy that we won the team championship. I'm glad to have the team behind me and to have great support from our coaching staff, led by Coach John Hammond. The fact that it started with our senior class right now, I'm happy that I can help them come full circle. Fifth national title under John Hammond. That is amazing. They have won 18 national championships since 1983, the first program to win four straight since University of Alaska Fairbanks, the Nanooks. One from 2001 to 2004. TCU, which is never a slouch, finished second. Murray State finished third. It's amazing. You had all of these college students hanging out together over a weekend, and not one of them was irresponsible. Not one of them was too drunk or too inebriated, too intoxicated to safely function. Nope. Because, you know, again, not all college students are drunken morons. In fact, I'd say most of them aren't. But again, there's this opinion being spouted by a lot of educators that these students that they teach are too irresponsible to handle their constitutional rights, too irresponsible to exercise their right to keep and bear arms. I realize, again, the competitive shooting sports, a little bit different than concealed carry, but fact remains, no, just because you are on a college campus doesn't mean that you are too irresponsible to handle a firearm. And we see this happen, again, the responsible, safe handling of firearms from coast to coast, across a lot of campuses, whether we're talking about competitive student athletes or we're talking about concealed carry holders. What we don't see are a lot of problems. All right, when we come back, Dave Adams of the Virginia Shooting Sports Association with us on the program. Stick around. There is more NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, coming up right after this.
You know, one of the things, too, that has really gone hand in hand and huge opportunity for Narissa and I, who are avid hunters, is our TV show, Universal Huntress. We're actually moving to Saturday nights this year on Pursuit, and we are able to go out. There's a need for something in the hunting industry. We're going to know. We spent 200 days in our first prototypes for our hunting line and came back and were able to go, I don't like this. I want this changed. You know, Narissa had her flair. I had my flair and the things that we were able to do. You know, it's just been a blessing to be able to have those opportunities. And now we actually showcase and feature on the show our hunting line and what we're doing to grow it, to change it. And you're going to see that a lot this year in season 3.
I believe that's called synergy. A lot more behind the scenes this year?
Yeah, a lot more behind the scenes.
You're going to get a little peek, sneak peek into GWG's world behind the scenes. And, of course, we also have our producer, Emmanuel Kapp, and he has Universal Hunter Magazine. I write in the magazine every month different articles from where we hunt and, you know, showcasing us from anywhere from a North American hunt to Argentina to New Zealand to Africa.
That is amazing. You all have just the coolest life and, the like I said, the greatest story. But you know, here's the thing. You've earned it, and you've worked for it. And I want to talk about that, if we can, for a second, because, you know, look, we live in an environment now where it's not the easiest thing to start your own business. It never is. But, you know, there are a lot of hurdles and impediments along the way, and yet you have done this. You've gone from a dream. And you've put in the sweat equity and you've made this a reality. Can you talk about some of the qualifications? What do you need? What are some of the tangibles and intangibles that a person has to have in order to take that idea? Because we all come up with great ideas all the time, but it's executing them. It's turning them into that reality. What do you need and what have you had to rely on to make Girls with Guns such a success?
You know, I would say the biggest thing right here, right now, would be the person for me sitting next to me, a partner, somebody that believes in you and that you believe in them, and you work together every day. Narissa and I are as opposite could be, with all the same beliefs, drive, and ambition. And so I'm the business side of GWG. I run everything from our e-commerce site and website, have a staff of 11 under me, and just love to do work with our sponsors, writing, things like that. Narissa is this fashion-forward person who loves to go shopping, and that sounds horrible to me, and get into... You talk a little bit more about what you like to do.
Yeah, I mean, you know, just the creative side, I love it. But, you know, if we could give any advice out there is, you know, just go after it. If you believe and you love and you're so passionate about your brand, you know, anything is possible. And as long as you have drive and, you know, your vision, just stay focused. And if you have good friends and good family, you know, their support is amazing. I mean, Cam, who would have ever thought that we would be here? I remember the first time you interviewed us, I couldn't even talk.
She was so nervous.
I was sweating. I mean, I'm probably sweating right now, but I mean, just, you know, just to see this and to share this with our fans and everybody is amazing. And, you know, this opportunity is fantastic. So we hope anybody out there wanting to start a brand, you know, go get after it. Yeah. Girl power.
Girl power. Well, as I said, it has been, it's been a lot of fun, and it's been really exciting to watch the growth and to get a chance to interview a couple of times a year. We try to catch up at SHOT Show at the NRA annual meeting, and every time it's, all right, tell me about your latest adventures. What have you been doing, you know, for the last 6 months? And you always have something cool going on. so, I mean, I don't know Do you sleep at all? How do you do this at this point when you've got the
company? No, I do not.
You mean you've got the Girls with Guns clothing line, you've got the business, as you say, then you've got the TV show, and you're constantly looking to add more and more. Do you have time to just stop and take a breath and just enjoy all of this, or are you just enjoying the ride at this point?
You know, for me, I love the ride. I'm very high energy, and I really don't sleep a whole lot. It is just an amazing journey, and how can you? I mean, you know, I figure I'll sleep when I'm dead because I'm going to take all of this in. My favorite part and the only time where I disconnect and shut down and literally am at one with nature is when I hunt.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by our friends at Nosler. Jed Babin of the American Spectator coming up next hour. Michael Graham as well down in Atlanta, Georgia, talking campus carry. But the legislative session is now over in Richmond, Virginia. Dave Adams of the Virginia Shooting Sports Association joins us for a legislative wrap-up. Dave, how are you, sir?
I'm doing great, Cam. How are you?
I am good. I appreciate you coming on the program. And it certainly was a busy legislative session here in Virginia, but I don't think gun control advocates are too happy with how it went.
No, they are probably wondering just what happened to them after starting the session, after Mark Herring gave them a gift before Christmas, and then a little over a month after that gift was given, the governor took it away in a deal with GOP leadership that not only expanded concealed carry, but also gave a couple of things that the General Assembly had not been willing to do in the past. But when you look at on balance, gun owners definitely got the better part of that deal.
The Roanoke newspapers, Alan Suderman, actually this was in the AP analysis, said McAuliffe has faced withering rebukes from his former allies. New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg's gun control group, Every Town for Gun Safety, ran ads in Virginia attacking him for the deal, saying it gives too much to gun rights advocates. And Dave, I'll be honest with you. I got to tell you, I haven't seen really any impact from those ads. I have not heard a lot of people complaining. I haven't heard anybody complaining, frankly, about the fact that Attorney General Herring's move was rescinded.
No, probably other than maybe Attorney General Herring, and he has kept that displeasure pretty much muted. I would not have wanted to be in the Attorney General's building because I'm sure they probably could have heard him screaming from the top floor all the way down to the bottom floor.
I am sure you're right. But, you know, look, Michael Bloomberg, I have no doubt he's going to continue to spend a lot of money in Virginia. It's a competitive state politically, so he's not going to ignore Virginia. But it should really be noted that I think more and more Virginians are ignoring Michael Bloomberg, Dave.
I think so. And, you know, I have to give it to the governor. You know, he could have withered under the attacks because he took it not only from Bloomberg, but some of the local gun control folks in the Commonwealth. And he stood his ground, said some things that I was actually quite surprised that a spokesman said regarding Bloomberg being a New York group and not being here in Virginia and not understanding the Virginia way. So I will give him kudos for, you know, standing his ground once he entered into the agreement and did so in good faith. But I don't think the vast majority of voters really think the way that Bloomberg and his little band of gun banners from New York think. And I think that's been evident by the support that we had for bills even before the agreement was reached. You had a bill that came out of the state Senate that would have basically overturned that order from Herring, and it had bipartisan support and could have withstood possibly a veto if it had not been for the agreement that was reached in late January.
There was another bill that came out late in the session, right, Dave? And Governor McAuliffe had tried to make some recommendations, wanted to make some changes to the bill. This was regarding expedited concealed carry permits for individuals who took out an order of protection. Is that right?
Yeah, it's House Bill 766 and the companion Senate Bill 626. He basically turned it into a predator protection bill because his changes would have required the person getting the protective order to have known ahead of time that they were going to get a protective order, because they would have had to have already applied for their carry permit. They would have had to have already taken the required training that is required under the law in Virginia, but they would not have been able to utilize the online training that everyone else can currently utilize to meet the training requirement. Both the House and the Senate rejected the governor's substitute. The House passed it in its enrolled form, which means they can, it's kind of like overriding a veto. With a two-thirds vote, you can pass the bill in its enrolled form and it would become law. However, when it got over to the Senate, it did not get the two-thirds majority. Both the House and the Senate originally passed the bills with veto-proof majorities, but it does go to show that he does still have enough credibility inside his own party, because it was on a party line vote that the Senate failed to pass the bill in its rolled form that would have made it law. So now it's gone back to the governor, and he can either veto it. I mean, he can either veto it, or he can go ahead and sign the original bill.
Okay, is this something that gun owners should be contacting the governor's office about?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he's got until April 11th to make this. It was communicated back to him, the action in both the House and the Senate. I know that on all the other bills, he has until April 11th to act. Now, on this particular bill, because it was done before the session ended, he may only have a certain amount of time to act. But I would suggest that gun owners do contact the governor and ask him to sign the bill as it was originally passed.
Talking again with Dave Adams, the Legislative Affairs Director with the Virginia Shooting Sports Association. Dave, what kind of presence did gun owners have at the legislature this year? Were we showing up for, you know, committee hearings, for lobby day? Were we there in Richmond?
There was a very vigorous presence on Martin Luther King Day, as it normally is, because that's when different groups get together and choose that day to go down and lobby legislators on a particular issue. And committee meetings had gun owners in force, especially when the bills that would have overturned Mark Herring's concealed carry actions were heard. And I think that's why you had bipartisan support. You had Democrats. I mean, you had enough Democrats voting for those bills that it would take 27 to override a veto, and you had those six Democrats joining with Republicans to pass those bills in a bipartisan fashion. I think that's because they heard from people in Virginia who are law-abiding concealed carry permit holders that they wanted to be able to carry in other states that we had recognition with, and they were afraid they were going to lose that ability because we were no longer going to recognize those 25 states' permits.
I think that you're absolutely right about that, Dave. And hopefully, you know, not that we have a lot of apathetic gun owners in the state of Virginia, but hopefully that did get people's attention. I know I certainly heard from a lot of people who are, you know, not ordinarily writing their lawmakers on a regular basis, and that had them fired up. That had them paying attention. And I think, you know, the more attention we pay, the more contact we're able to give to our state representatives, our state senators, the more that they know we're paying attention to issues like this, then the more success we can see in stopping bad things from happening, even in a state like Virginia, a battleground state where we are told all the time that gun owners, it's only a matter of time before the gun control laws start passing here. We can use our voice and we can actually, you know, bring real common sense to Richmond.
It definitely showed what can happen when gun owners get energized on an issue and make their voice heard. And I think it also was a wake-up call to show us that what happens regularly in D.C. now has the opportunity to happen if the wrong people are in office in Virginia.
Absolutely. Dave, listen, I appreciate you coming on the program, sir. And what is the Legislative Affairs Director for the Virginia Shooting Sports Association doing in the off-season?
I get back to do my real job more often than I get to do it during the legislative session.
Good for you. I imagine the family's awfully happy that the legislative session is over as well. And hopefully we'll get a chance to see you here not too long from now in Louisville.
I will definitely be there, yes.
Excellent. We'll see you there. Dave Adams of the Virginia Shooting Sports Association. Thank you again, sir. Join us here on NRA News, Cam and Company. We are just a little more than 2 months away from the NRA annual meeting in Louisville. May 19th, I believe, is the opening day. NRAAM.org is the website. I do know that. And I also know that if you're planning on going to Louisville, Kentucky for the annual meeting this year, you want to go ahead and make your hotel reservations now, because it's going to get busy, really busy. But it's going to be a fantastic time on May 19th through the 22nd at the Kentucky Exposition Center. May 20th is the Friday kickoff, so really Friday, Saturday, Sunday, but you can get there Thursday. They're going to be you'll be able to sign up and register, and that way you're ready to go on Friday morning. If you go to NRAAM.org, you can get help with your hotel reservations. You can pre-register for the annual meeting, and it is going to be a fantastic time. I am really looking forward to seeing a lot of our friends and a lot of our listeners and viewers. It's always fun at the annual meeting. It's always 3 days of just work, but you're working right there on the floor of the convention center, and, you know, you've got just no shortage of things to see and do. It's always a blur, the annual meeting. It's not one of these days, years and years from now, I will retire and I'll actually get to go to the annual meeting simply as an NRA member. The experience when you're there, because we'd like to bring as much of it as possible to those who can't make it. So we're on the air with special Saturday shows, Sunday shows. We've got the members meeting that we broadcast on Saturday morning. We've got the Celebration of American Values Leadership Forum that we typically broadcast on Friday afternoon. We've got a lot of special programming beyond NRA News, Cam and Company, the regular program that we bring you. But it is just the coolest experience. And last year in Nashville was utterly unbelievable. To see the convention spill out beyond the convention center itself onto the streets of Nashville, and the entire downtown just sort of looked like the NRA annual meeting. It was just amazing. Louisville, I think, is going to be just as good. I have no idea how many people are going to attend, but I know that it's going to be a pretty good-sized city of NRA members who will be coming to Louisville May 19th through the 22nd. Now, coming up next hour, Michael Graham talking some campus carry down in Georgia, where Governor Nathan Deal has campus carry legislation on his desk. Also, Jed Babin talking about President Obama's foreign policy, calling it the Libyan bleep show. And we might not be done yet, as a matter of fact. Plus, we have another IT guy from the State Department who does not want to talk to Congress about Hillary Clinton's private email system. Huh. How about that? Politico reporting John Bentel, who retired from the State Department in December of 2012, has told the House Select Committee on Benghazi and the State Judiciary and Homeland Security Committees that he won't talk to them. Nope, just not going to. He said he had no memory or knowledge about the server. He was the Director of Information Resources Management of the Office of Executive Secretariat. So it was his job to oversee IT for the senior level officials there at the State Department, including the secretary. Over at Hot Air, Jazz Shaw says details dug up by the Daily Caller certainly raise more than a few questions about Mr. Bentel's sudden loss for words or memory problems. Not only did his staff seem to be aware of the workings of both the private server and Secretary Clinton's BlackBerry, but his boss, Stephen Mull, is thought to have been in the loop as well. If the people above and below him have information about the course of events under study, was Mr. Bentel simply out of the loop? Asks Jazz about what was going on in his office, or is he suffering from some sort of tragic memory loss? Yeah, well, remember, one individual, Brian Pagliano, who was responsible for directly managing the server, has already been granted immunity in exchange for talking to investigators. Now, that wasn't congressional immunity. That was immunity from DOJ. So who knows what might happen with the second individual who was working in IT at the State Department. As Jazz says, it is going to be a long, hot summer, and things are just starting to get interesting. Yeah, and, you know, the media, it's amazing. For an entity that has, you know, tons of reporters and supposedly the capability to cover lots of different stories. They are rather myopic, it seems, lately when it comes to our elections. And the media, I think, much more interested, not just in covering, but in encouraging chaos on the right, while really failing to show a similar amount of interest in the divisions on the left between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton and their supporters. And the real continuing issue here with the investigation into the security of Hillary Clinton's server and the emails, many of whom we know now, or many of which we know now, were classified. That investigation seems to not really be a big story for a lot of media entities these days, right? Much rather cover the every burp and giggle on the Republican side of the presidential campaign. All right, stick around. Hour two of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. It's coming up right after this.
Speaking with Command Sergeant Major Patrick Valdez, he's retired, and he's now with Freedom Hunters. Patrick, thank you so much for being here, and we'll go right to the shot of what you tell us what you do, because this makes a very big impression when you wield this up to the set here. Tell us what's Freedom Hunters all about, and tell us about the chair.
Freedom Hunters, we're a nonprofit. We take all veterans, all wars, all branches, and outdoor shooting activities, to include hunting, target shooting, trap, long range, whatever we can get the guy out. It started out with the Wounded Warrior Program at Fort Carson, Colorado, and to get guys out of the barracks, kind of like what Healing Waters did. It's hunting and getting guys outdoors. When you get back from a combat environment, you want to go back and do the things you did before. You want peace, you want calm, you want quiet. And getting guys outdoors and gals is our primary mission.
So tell us about the chair you brought along.
The chair is an amazing device. It's the Action Track Chair. It's an American-made. It runs 5 miles an hour. We can get guys, and I say guys being guys and gals, into places they can't get with a normal wheelchair. Little skinny tires get stuck in the mud, stuck in the sand. We put them in this, and we can get them right to a blind. We can get them to a duck or a goose blind. We've taken them elk hunting, mule deer out west. We've even taken them fly fishing. With it.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, it can go into a little bit of water, not a lot.
Awesome.
It is battery operated. And it's just a great tool to get guys out. And it gives them independence. It gets the guys in a chair the freedom to get off the concrete and get into the snow, sand, dirt, whatever, and not have to worry about getting stuck.
So why did you do this?
You know, I started out as a patient in the program. I got injured in Iraq in February of 2007. And Freedom Hunters came to me and said, when they were really small, they said, we heard you want to go do something different. And I'd never been waterfowl hunting, so they took me, and that's how I started with them. So I was initially a patient in the program, cool. Then I became a mentor. Now that I'm retired and have a little more time on my hands, I work as an outreach coordinator helping the guys out.
That's awesome. Talking with Patrick Valdez with Freedom Hunters. So, Patrick, I was out at Camp Perry one time at the Nationals there, and I knew exactly what you were talking about. There was another organization who worked with wounded vets, and they got them out hunting and shooting. Those guys just, you know, it's what they grew up doing. It's why a lot of them got into the service to begin with, and they're just so happy just to be getting out there again and just being out with the guys. It's hugely impactful to them.
Well, it's an independence issue. You know, when they get back, they're well medicated, they're being taken care of, they have all of these appointments, and then they're like, I just want to go be by myself or get back into the wild. And especially at Camp Perry, it's a little sandy there.
Yeah.
And I've seen what wheelchairs do there, and they sink. And then all their buddies, usually four of them, drag them to the firing line. And I've been on hunts where we didn't have a track chair available, and we had to drag the guy in his chair up to a blind.
Yeah. So something like that chair can't be cheap. So tell me, I'm obvious you guys probably need support. So we've got about 30 seconds left here. Tell us about Freedom Hunters. How can people get involved? How can they help out?
Freedomhunters.org, first of all. Come to our site. vets can register and to get on a hunt themselves. Landowners can bring opportunities to shoot. There's the Independence Fund that's available, and Action Track Chair has their own 501c3 where there are scholarships available or funding available to get a chair on your own.
Patrick Valdez, Freedom Hunters, thank you so much for what you're doing, and thanks for being here on NRA News. Please keep up good work and stay in touch, okay?
Welcome back. Hour two of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, starts right now. On the program this hour, Michael Graham talking campus carry down in Georgia. Also, Jed Babin of the American Spectator on the sad demise of any sort of foreign policy from the Obama administration. We're going to talk with John Cardillo, host of the John Cardillo Show next hour, about the attacks on police officers this weekend. A new survey of New York police officers expressing the grave dissatisfaction with their job and with the way the department is being run here. In Detroit, there's a story. I thought about using this as our deal of the day today, but we've got another story here. Federal judges in Detroit granting bond to career criminals. Teresa Baldus of the Detroit Free Press reporting this story. You know, Hillary Clinton had this CNN town hall style event, another town hall style event from CNN last night, this time featuring the Democratic candidates, asked a question about what Hillary Clinton would do to what programs she would implement to crack down on gang related violence. And what she said was, well, we need more gun control laws. That's what we need. You know, and again, you look at the individuals held for the murder of Tyshawn Lee in Chicago, felons, all of them, illegal to possess a firearm. And in fact, when, you know, one of these individuals was charged with Dwight Boone Doty, I think it was his name, 22 years old, convicted of armed robbery, gets a 5-year sentence. He does 2 years and 1 month of that 5-year sentence for armed robbery. And then he's put back out on the streets. Hillary Clinton says, well, we can solve all this problem if we just have another law regarding the private transfer of firearms. And, oh, yeah, if we hold gun manufacturers accountable for the actions of these violent criminals, then we can get tough on gang violence. It seems to me that Hillary Clinton is ignoring the problem here. And we've got similar stories all over the country. I mean, this is not a Chicago story. This is a story about what the criminal justice system looks like in 2016 in the United States of America. So Teresa Baldus with the Detroit Free Press has this story. She says, when a man with paranoid schizophrenia showed up at the Ambassador Bridge with a loaded gun in his shoe and claimed that he sometimes hears voices telling him to hurt people, an arrest and criminal charges quickly followed. Prosecutors urged a federal judge in Detroit to lock him up until his trial, but the judge set him free on bond, even after conceding the defendant had, quote, one of the longest prior criminal records that I've ever seen. The man had cancer, so the judge sent him to live with his mom in Pittsburgh in January to make sure that he got proper medical care, pending the outcome of his case. Eyebrows went up in the courtroom. Observers shook their heads. Prosecutors appealed to a judge across the hall but lost. Baldus says, this is what prosecutors often face in the Eastern District of Michigan, which prides itself as having one of the highest bond release rates in the country. Setting about two-thirds of criminal defendants free on bond annually. Over the last decade, the district's release rate has ranged between 60 and 79%. Comparatively, less than half of defendants nationwide get bond, with last year's national record, national rate dipping to about 31%. So about twice as likely to get out on bond in the federal Eastern District of Michigan. Again, this is not district court. This is the federal court system. The region's judges, Baldus writes, and many in the law enforcement community consider this a bragging point, also noting that the district has one of the highest bond success rates. About 90% of those released on bond return to court and stay out of trouble, compared with the national average rate of 72%. For prosecutors, though, and victims' rights advocates, the release numbers are a source of growing frustration, particularly considering the Eastern District of Michigan covers three of the most violent cities in America, Detroit, Flint, and Saginaw. and has one of the heaviest dockets for violent crime. Joshua Marquis, a 19-year member of the board of directors of the National District Attorneys Association, who believes too many repeat offenders get the benefit of the doubt when they should be locked up, said part of the problem in America today is a general belief that we just need to give people more chances. But I think a lot of prosecutors are frustrated. When you look at a person's rap sheet, the best predictor of future behavior is past behavior. U.S. Attorney Barbara McQuaid telling the Detroit Free Press, while reasonable minds can disagree about a legal decision, we are sometimes frustrated by decisions to grant bond to dangerous defendants whose release may cause witnesses to feel intimidated, contributing to the no-snitch culture. In light of our recent focus on more dangerous offenders, such as violent gang leaders, we expect to seek detention more frequently. And she said we have a duty to protect not just the public at large, but also the victims and witnesses in a particular case. Now, Chief U.S. District Judge Denise Page Hood said, look, prosecutors can challenge the decisions. That's fine. But she said that the high release rate on bond is a good thing, because it lets defendants keep their jobs and family ties and remain a productive part of society pending trial. That is, if they are a productive member of society in the first place. She says other districts look at us and say, how do they do that? They have a high release rate and a high return rate. We're a role model. But the Detroit Free Press says prosecutors and victims' rights advocates aren't convinced. Over the last 6 months, federal judges let out several defendants who prosecutors believe are too dangerous and or flight risks, including an accused high-level heroin dealer with 8 prior arrests and 5 criminal convictions, a drug fugitive who had been on the run for 15 years, again, released on bond after he was caught, an accused child pornographer who allegedly took nude photos of young boys at camp and posted them on a Russian website, and a mentally ill drug user with multiple convictions. Huh. Standing before a veteran federal judge with a reputation for giving people second chances, the Free Press writes, Damon Burnett, an accused heroin dealer with 5 prior criminal convictions, promised that he wouldn't mess up if he was released on bond. U.S. District Judge Avern Cohn told Burnett during an October hearing, you know, if I release you and you screw up, who's going to get the blame? I'm going to get the blame. I'm the one that's going to be embarrassed. Burnett replied, I would never embarrass you. Judge said, okay. Now, no offense to Damon Burnett here, the accused heroin dealer with 5 prior criminal convictions, but do you think that he's ever said something like that to someone he is supposed to care about more than a judge? Like maybe family? Friends, people who love them, I would never embarrass you. And do you think he's let them down with 5 prior criminal convictions? Federal prosecutors argued in court documents, Damon Burnett is a high-level drug trafficker with the means to flee to avoid a potential lifetime in prison. He is a clear danger to the community. They have sought intervention 3 times from a federal appeals court. They've argued that Burnett, who as a convicted felon is not allowed to possess handguns, was caught with 11 firearms in his house, including 6 loaded handguns that were stuffed in shoes, as well as 3 rifles. FBI agents also found, quote, wanted posters for snitches hidden under his mattress, heroin, crack cocaine, a kilogram press, and masking agents to throw off drug-sniffing dogs at 2 homes tied to Mr. Burnett. He also has 5 prior weapons arrests, resulting in 3 convictions for drug-related arrests with 2 convictions. He has a history of failure to appear. Continued criminal activity while on supervision, a history of violating the terms of bond conditions, a long history of substance abuse, and ties to a $1 million heroin ring. Oh, yeah, and 2 of his co-defendants have been shot since Burnett was arrested on suspicions that they were cooperating. One of them died. But he told the judge he would not embarrass him. I mean, he looked him in the eye and said, I won't embarrass you. So they appealed this up to the Sixth Circuit. Sixth Circuit kicked it back down to Judge Cohn. Judge Cohn continued bond, concluding that there was no proof that Burnett ever used any of the guns that were found in his home in an illegal manner, and that there's no history of violence in his criminal record.
Okay. February 29th, prosecutors filed their third appeal. But meanwhile, Burnett remains free on bond. And this is, again, well above the national average. 72% of these defendants getting bond in the Eastern District of Michigan. The Detroit Free Press quotes Bill Swore, vice president of the American Board of Criminal Lawyers. He says that pretrial release should be the norm in federal court. He said, remember, someone who's accused of a crime is presumed innocent, and to detain someone, to physically restrain someone, runs counter to that presumption of innocence. He said, our district takes that presumption quite seriously. I, for one, he says, agree with it. You know, he's right. You do have a presumption of innocence, which is why prosecutors, again, have to explain to a judge why they believe bond should be set. Either at a very high level or not set at all, as opposed to bond being set at a level at which someone can bond out. Someone who doesn't have a previous criminal history, someone who may have a previous criminal history, but you know what? They've always shown up for court. They have always shown up if they were sentenced to probation before. They've not had any. They followed the criminal justice system outside of breaking the law to begin with. Those individuals are likely to get bond. In some states, like California, where you've got a real criminal justice crisis right now, you're probably more likely to get bond at a district court level. But when prosecutors are able to point to, again, a lengthy criminal history, or a danger to society, or a danger that these individuals will flee. Judges certainly, again, have the option of saying, okay, because we're concerned we're not going to be able to bring this case to trial if we let you remain free on bond until then, they absolutely have the option of setting that bond at a high level, revoking bond altogether. Prosecutors have to convince a judge, the Detroit Free Press says, that no conditions can reasonably assure the community's safety or the appearance of the defendant if the defendant is released. And then a detention hearing is held during which judges weigh several factors, including the seriousness and nature of the crime, the defendant's criminal history, family ties, employment, any history of drug or alcohol abuse, and the weight of the evidence against them. The criminal defense attorney said, we don't have problems here. We don't have people being released and then running out and committing crimes. We don't have people not showing up for court. It works. Except for the fact that, you know, again, Detroit and Flint and Saginaw are some of the more violent cities in the country. Besides that, sure, it appears to be working. All right, coming up in just a couple minutes, Mr. Michael Graham is going to join us. We're going to talk campus carry down in Georgia. Governor Nathan Deal has House Bill 859 on his desk. That is the campus carry measure. There are, just like we saw in Texas, again, a number of professors and academics in Georgia who are very upset about the prospect of concealed carry holders being able to lawfully carry on a college campus. We're getting a lot of arguments about irresponsible, drunken college students. Meanwhile, in Maine, a bill that we've been talking about over the past couple of months or so, remember the case of Harvey Limbo, right? The homeowner in Maine had been the subject of several burglaries. He's a disabled individual, 67 years old, uses a wheelchair to get around. He ended up buying a firearm for his protection. The day after he bought that firearm, somebody broke into his house. Harvey Limbo had to use that firearm in self-defense. And then he was told by the property management company that runs the apartment complex where Harvey lives that he violated the lease agreement by having that firearm, so he was going to have to leave. So there's a bill, LD 1572 in Maine, that would prohibit individuals or property management companies or individuals from barring firearm possession by tenants in their subsidized housing. The Criminal Justice and Public Safety Committee ended up voting 7-6 to recommend passage of the bill. So it now heads to the House and the Senate in Maine for further debate. There was an amendment, according to the Bangor Daily News, to allow landlords who own and live in apartment buildings with four or fewer units to still ban firearms in their federally subsidized units. Representative Lori Fowle, a Democrat who voted against the bill, says, I think it's a big reach for state government to get involved in a private property issue between a landlord and tenant. People talk about local control, but I'm not sure what is more local than this private property matter. Well, you know, again, we're talking about subsidized housing here. We have seen court cases around the country. In fact, if you watch this program, you may have seen the Freedom Save His Place spot featuring Josephine Bird, who lives in Wilmington, Delaware, lives in public housing, and was one of the plaintiffs who sued because the Wilmington Housing Authority told Josephine that she couldn't keep a firearm in her home. They wanted to ban people like Josephine. They wanted to ban everybody there in public housing from owning a firearm. Now, you listen to Josephine, and she'll tell you how well that worked. You know, again, people like her who were worried about being put out on the street, they abided, but they lived in fear of those who did not. And so, again, Josephine, along with several other plaintiffs there in Delaware, with the help of the NRA, took the Women in Housing Authority to court, took all the housing authorities in Delaware to court. And ultimately, the Wilmington Housing Authority rescinded their ban on gun ownership. And Josephine was able to exercise her right to keep and bear arms in her house, which, you know, the Supreme Court hasn't given us a lot of rulings on the Second Amendment. But in the Heller decision, they did make it abundantly clear that you do have the fundamental individual right to keep a firearm in your home for self-defense. Now, if you want to argue against that, go for it. But the argument against this bill in Maine, again, seems to be a false argument of a property issue between a landlord and a tenant. Representative Lori Fowle, who voted against the bill, also said, according to the Bangor Daily News, that the bill could have unintended consequences by possibly causing landlords who accept public assistance funds to stop doing so and to discourage new landlords from participating in the programs. Now, keep in mind that the status quo right now, where someone like Harvey Limbo can be put out on the streets for using a firearm of self-defense in their home, might also discourage people from, I don't know, exercising their constitutional rights. But apparently Representative Fowle is a little bit more concerned about landlords possibly stepping away from the Section 8 program as opposed to the rights of the people in Section 8 housing to defend themselves and their loved ones. All right, when we come back after a quick break, Michael Graham talking campus carry down in Georgia. Stick around. We have much more. NRA News Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, coming up right after this quick timeout.
Here at the NRA annual meetings, this is a new program. This is so cool. This is Mike Flory with NRA for Pets. Good to meet you, Mike.
Nice to meet you.
I got to tell you, this is going to be a very biased interview because I am a dog and pet a lover like crazy. So it's very cool to see that there's an NRA for Pets program. What is it?
Well, basically, it's a program that we put together for the NRA to provide services for all pet owners. We have from prescription medications to NRA-branded treats. We have pet insurance. We have pet information. It's a website you go to. You support the NRA when you go there. You buy the things you're buying today and save money and make money for the NRA. So it's a great opportunity. Everybody wins, even the four-legged ones. What we want to provide is quality services and quality merchandise that the person feels good about buying. We take a lot of the guesswork out of selection. There's just thousands of different pet foods, treats. We picked out the best for them, and hopefully they'll take advantage of it and save some money on the way.
Talk about pet insurance. I mean, now, you know, of course, NRA pet insurance, but just in general, the idea of pet insurance, why is it so important?
Well, it's important for the same way it's important for humans. You have a need to go to a veterinarian, it's going to cost you money. So how do you offset those money? There's emergencies, there's accidents, there's sicknesses, and we want to make sure that you have an opportunity to insure those so that you're out-of-pocket costs are limited, but more than that, we want to make sure you get the care for your pet that you wouldn't maybe because you couldn't afford it.
Yeah. When you're at when you're debuting something like this, first of all, the crowd of this booth is unbelievable. You've got to be overwhelmed by the response.
Yeah, actually, we are. We were here. We were in Indianapolis last year, and we talked about. You know, NRA for Pets, we were putting it together. So we were kind of polling the audience. Overwhelmingly, people said, great, do it. Let's do it. But we weren't ready for this kind of reception. I mean, you just watch people walk by, and they look at it and go, oh, NRA for Pets.
I work for the NRA News, and I did that.
Right? I didn't know, and we have to say, well, you didn't know because it's brand new. Yeah. You know, it rolled out just now.
Mike Flory, where should people go online?
Well, go online at nraforpets.com.
Speaking with Barry Woods with the National Wild Turkey Federation, welcome to NRA News. How are you, Barry?
I'm doing good. Thanks for having us.
Well, thanks for being here. We love National Wild Turkey Federation. You guys are a great organization. But, Barry, for those who don't know, who are watching us, what is National Wild Turkey Federation? What do you guys do?
We are in the business right now of creating hunters. We just started a new initiative called Save the Habitat, Save the Hunt. And over the course of the next 10 years through our volunteer base, we're going to create 1.5 million new hunters.
That's awesome. Why did you guys feel it was necessary to do this?
Because, unfortunately, hunter numbers are on a decline. And we recognized right away that if we're going to continue this heritage of the outdoors, that we're going to have to get kids off the couch, away from video games, and back into the outdoors. So, and we've also learned that several folks have gotten out of hunting for a number of different reasons, lack of access, lease prices, and things like that. So that's the other side of the initiative is the habitat side, and we want to open access to 500,000 acres to help those people that we create to be hunters have a place to hunt.
That sounds great. So how are you going to go about doing this? You talked about opening access. What else is in the plan?
The other thing we're doing right now is what we're calling R3 is retention, recruitment, and reactivation. And we're also holding events across the country through our volunteer base where entire families can get involved in the shooting sports. We realized real quick that Pittman-Robertson Act and the way that it works in conservation is very important to the hunting heritage. And so we got to get these folks back engaged in the outdoors. So they can get to our website at nwtf.org.
Tell folks, why should they check out your website in this new initiative?
If you want to play a role in getting hunters and recruiting hunters and becoming a volunteer with the NWTF, it's going to take a workforce. It's going to take a lot of people coming on board and helping us achieve this mission. And so if you're interested in that, you need to get on our website.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company. Your first source for Second Amendment news and information. Probably not your first source for Pat Benatar songs, but every now and then. Who knows? Michael Graham, host of the Michael Graham Show on News Radio 106.7 in Atlanta, Georgia, is with us on the show right now. Michael, how you doing, sir?
I am currently unarmed, but I hope to change that.
Well, good. I am glad to hear that you're at least hoping to change that.
Well, I have to be armed. My wife is nearby, so I need a way to defend myself. Right now I'm relying on a baseball bat and a stick. So.
Well, listen, they say love is a battlefield. At least Pat Benatar says
exactly
that.
Exactly myself.
Right?
Exactly.
Yeah,
I tell her, stop using sex as a weapon, but she won't listen to me. I don't know.
And there are a lot of college professors apparently in Georgia who thinks that college campuses will be a battlefield soon if campus carry is signed into law by Governor Nathan Deal.
Well, let me me share a personal anecdote. And I know anecdotal evidence, you know, it's measured, whatever. But my daughter is a student at Georgia State University right in downtown Atlanta. She just transferred down from UMass for this semester. So this is her first semester. The first week she's there, there are three robberies at gunpoint in the library, the most boring place on campus, the mm-hmm. school library. And there's a local school sandwich place that gets shot up. Now, none of these are done by people who have lawful firearms. It's all, you know, gangbanger and crooks. And so I obviously, as a dad, even though she's only, whatever, you know, 20 minutes away from me right now, I'm freaking out, going, what the heck? And in what's hilarious is that the Georgia State University campus is right by the state capitol. So these legislators know that their gun-free zone is being used for, you know, robbery and target practice, because they can see it from their step, from the steps, and yet the governor's still not sure what he's going to do.
Well, I hope that gun owners contact Governor Deal and urge him to support the measure. You know, it, as you say, we saw these armed robberies at Georgia State and the library there. Glenn Reynolds, I know you know the Instapundit.
Yes.
He recently wrote about when his daughter was a freshman at Georgia Tech, there were armed robberies. And this was a couple of years ago. There were armed robberies in the dorms there at Georgia Tech. And Glenn said he wrote the president of Georgia Tech, you know, as a concerned parent, never heard a word back from the president. He said, you know, and so Glenn said, listen, if you're considering going to Georgia Tech, you know, I have to tell you, I was a little disappointed in how unconcerned they were about my daughter's safety here. You know, and I know, Michael, that campuses are not crime free, that gun free zones are not something that criminals really look to obey, and that, you know, frankly and unfortunately, college students are seen as easy targets by criminals who are looking for, you know, an easy mark to rob.
Of course they are. And why wouldn't they be? Because college kids are barely, vaguely aware of what's going on around them. They're clueless. So they roam, they've got $400 or $500 worth of electronic equipment in their backpack, and they throw the backpack around. They don't know where it is because they're dopes. And that's one of the arguments that the people who oppose this make is, do we really need these college kids, you know, armed, given they can barely keep track of their, you know, driver's license and their, you know, cell phone and where they kept their pot? But one of the things that this law does is you have to be licensed to carry already. In other words, the only people that are going to avail themselves of this are people who are already responsible gun owners. This isn't going to be a bunch of frat boys go, hey, what are you going to do on Thursday night? Let's go get us some guns. You're already going to be, number one, you'll have to be 21. And number two, you'll always have to, already have to, in other words, it would be like, can you be a regular citizen who already has this right and have it transfer with you to college campus? It's not creating a new right or a new class of gun owner.
No, that's absolutely right. And this is, you know, I know that we've seen some professors there in Georgia who were complaining about this very thing, right? It was, these students are just too irresponsible. They're too stupid. They're always drunk, Michael. You know, they're out of their right minds. So there's no way that they should be allowed to carry a firearm. But as you point out, these are people who are already carrying off campus, right? They have their concealed carry license. So they are carrying off campus. They're not causing mayhem throughout the rest of Georgia. And frankly, you know, when I hear a professor say that these students are just too drunk, they're too responsible, there's too much of a problem with drinking or drugs on campus, I always wonder, are they demanding that cars be taken away from these same students? You know, should these same students be able to get behind the wheel of a car, given how irresponsible and inebriated they apparently always are?
And we just had an incident where, and you probably talked to the story of the guy with the hatchet who showed up at a 7-Eleven the other day and started swinging away. And fortunately, there was an armed guy who went there every morning for his, you know, morning coffee, which, by the way, who wants that life if your morning coffee starts at 7-Eleven? But whatever. And he just pulls out the gun and bam. And this was in super anti-gun Seattle, Washington. And the local police official played the audio on my radio show today, said, we're not charging this guy with anything. He did something good. The clerk is still alive and the bad guy is dead. And those incidents will increase if there are a handful of Georgia college students who are already 21, already trained, and they're bringing their weapons on campus. It's going to be a message to all the people who need to get it.
Talking again with Michael Graham, host of the Michael Graham Show on 106.7 News Radio, 106.7 in Atlanta. Have you been talking about this issue at all, Michael, on the air? And if so, what are your listeners saying?
Oh, yeah, this was part of the conversation today. Specifically, the we tied in the hatchet story, and I tweeted out to my listeners. We talked about it on the air. I hope Governor Deal saw this story because, look, everything is two-sided. Everything that can be used for good can be used for ill, and so on and on and on. But as you point out all the time on your show, the bad guys are going to get the guns anyway. They're going to use guns anyway. This completely changes the dynamic, particularly on an urban campus like Georgia Tech and Georgia State, where my daughter is. If they know that when you cross the street onto campus territory, the good guys' guns don't suddenly disappear. If you're a thug and you want to steal a couple grand worth of stuff, you know, in a week, why wouldn't you hang out on campus? The kids are there, particularly Georgia Tech. They're more affluent kids. They've got, like I said earlier, electronics and other stuff. They're just easy pickings. As soon as you stir in 1% or even 0.5% of those kids are concealed carry, it completely changes the dynamic.
Yeah, and it's not just college students either. I mean,
right?
Presumably you would have some faculty members. Now, they may not want to tell their colleagues, hey, I'm a concealed carry holder and I'll be carrying if campus carry becomes law, because they may not want to have to deal with their colleagues' freak out over no reason. Right. But I imagine that what you're going to find, again, you've got to be 21 to get your concealed carry license in the state of Georgia. I imagine what you're going to find are a lot of upperclassmen. Frankly, I think you'll probably find a lot of non-traditional students, those who are a little bit older, maybe some veterans, people who are concerned about, getting out of a night class and walking to their vehicle, as well as people who, again, are already concealed carry holders. And this would be one more place where they could lawfully and legally carry. So,
And you've got dads like me who had a long conversation with my daughter. My daughter's never fired a gun in her whole life. It's not her thing. But we've talked about it, and she's gone from no way to thinking about it. And if she decides to do it, she'll go through the process and she'll be one of those responsible gun owners. So by opening this door, you're causing the good guys to think about arming themselves, as opposed to right now where what's the point? You can't access the gun when you need it anyway.
Absolutely. And, I'll tell you, when my oldest daughter was in college in Oklahoma, we didn't have campus carry in Oklahoma, but this was a real concern of mine because my daughter worked off campus at a restaurant. She closed a lot of times. She didn't have a car, so she would bicycle. She lived, went to school in a small town in Oklahoma, but it wasn't crime free again. And she would actually have to bike back and forth to campus at night. Wow. And, it was awful as a dad thinking about this. We had lots of conversations about how she could protect herself. And it's not that she was completely defenseless, but, she did not have that option available to her.
Well, I went to college in Oklahoma, and the nightmare you just gave me is being on a bike in Oklahoma. That's the nightmare right there. Oh, my God. It's stinking, burning hot in the summer, freezing in the winter, and the place is full of pickup trucks being driven by people who are too busy singing along with the country music to pay attention to where they're going. How she survived that is beyond me.
But at least you don't have to worry about pedaling up any hills.
That is true. It's all flat. Absolutely. It's funny. I was in Tulsa. They called it the heart of green country because that's where the one tree was.
That's right.
So it was green country.
And as someone who grew up in Oklahoma City, Tulsa actually absolutely was the green part of the state. We envied you that tree. Hey, listen, I appreciate you coming on the program as always, Michael. It's good talking with you, sir.
Anytime. Call anytime. It's my pleasure.
All right. We'll talk again soon. Michael Graham, host of the Michael Graham Show on News Radio 106.7 in Atlanta, Georgia. Talking again about campus carry, and there you go. Michael, well aware of the armed robberies there at the library at Georgia State because, his daughter on campus there at Georgia State. Interestingly enough, even in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, there are no shortages of people who are in favor of this. And kudos to the Atlanta Journal-Constitution for actually acknowledging this. Because it is very easy, again, to hype up the anti-gun voices and to downplay or ignore those who are supportive or at least open-minded about campus carry. Georgia State Senior Anissa Williams told the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, "When I wake up in the morning, headed to campus for 7 a.m. class and get an email that there's been an armed robbery on campus, I'm a pretty pro-choice person." Meanwhile, the other side, Alexander Evans, grad student at Emory University, wrote, campus carry would compromise the learning environment and change peer learning and professor-student relationships. How would it do that? I mean, this goes back again to the argument that, well, concealed carry is going to chill speech on campus, to which I say, have you seen the news from college campuses these days? First of all, when campus carry was implemented in Utah, when campus carry was implemented in Colorado, when campus carry has been implemented in any of the, we're up to 8 states now where the law has been passed, could you find any evidence that speech was chilled, that there was not a robust debate where one existed before, and that the demise of that robust debate was because of a campus carry? I don't think you can. It's fascinating, again, that we have people who are so concerned about robust debate going away on college campuses that they want to do everything that they can to stop campus carry from being implemented. Meanwhile, they don't seem to be doing much about the chilling of free speech and the silencing of debate that's happening right now. In fact, was it last week we were talking about a story out of California, I think it was, USC, where a student senator was facing impeachment for inviting Milo Yiannopoulos to speak there. The College Fix reporting that a top official at the University of Southern California told the College Fix that campus leaders have no plans to stop the student-led impeachment effort against an outspoken conservative student government member who is also president of the USC College Republicans. USC Vice President of Student Affairs Dr. Ainsley Carey told the Fix, quote, self-governance is an essential part of the student experience at the University of Southern California. The democratic process for the undergraduate student government is well documented in their official bylaws, and we respect their right to pursue that process without interference. So, an impeachment hearing for Jacob Ellenhorn, president of the USC College Republicans, remains scheduled for later this month, the College Fix says, in part because the complaint filed by a fellow student government member Diana Jimenez says that Ellenhorn, quote, misuses his title while representing our student body inappropriately. He was accused of creating a hostile environment by hosting a speaker who, quote, blatantly perpetuates sexism. And takes issue with his filming of a USC sexual consent fair earlier this year, saying he did not fill out the proper paperwork to record it. Cameron, does the phrase sexual consent fair just kind of make you twitch a little bit?
Yes. Yes, very
okay,
much
good.
So.
That's not just me.
No, it's a very frightening, very frightening prospect.
Okay, glad it's not just me. So this is what's taking place again on college campuses right now. And then you've got, here's another one. This is from KCUR in Kansas. A professor in Kansas concerned because campus carry is scheduled to go into effect there in 2017. KCUR quotes a professor, Alan Greiner. Alan Greiner. This was, where is this? The story itself is on the KU Medical Center and how this is going to impact the KU Medical Center. But they quote a professor as saying, I think a lot of faculty members will consider moving on if this is enacted. We've seen, again, professors in Texas say, I'm leaving, I'm going to Australia, I'm leaving, I'm going to the University of Pennsylvania, where, again, they have had students robbed there on campus because they are concerned about campus carry legislation. Now, if you're concerned about this, let's talk about it. But let's really talk about these concerns as opposed to just venting our spleen about how irresponsible and uneducated again, inebriated these college students are and what a horrible idea this is. let's talk this through. Again, this is supposed to be an institution of higher learning that we're talking about here. Let's reason our way through this debate about campus carry. Not getting a lot of that from professors, unfortunately. All right, when we return here on this edition of NRA News, Cam and Company, Jed Babin from the American Spectator. Next hour, we've got John Cardillo, Tim Lee, Hero, Deal, Good Guy, and more. Stick around. We'll be right back here on NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler.
I'm speaking with David Agata and Ron Sasaki with AmericanSnipers.org. Gentlemen, welcome to NRA News.
Thanks. Thanks for having us.
Tell me, what is AmericanSnipers.org all about?
We're a nonprofit, totally volunteer. Nobody makes any money. But basically what we do is we raise money, we buy gear, and we send it to military snipers overseas to do the business that needs to be done.
And how did you start this?
In 2002-2003, we're basically police snipers from around the country. There's a big, I guess, the community's very tight, but there's a wide spread of us. And a couple of us were being deployed as reservists and National Guard. As snipers, they were also police snipers, and they needed gear that they didn't have available. So we put that together, started this little project, raised a little bit of money, and then realized there was a big need. And that was 2003. We've since grown legs, and here we are 14 years later, still raising money, sending gear to snipers in country.
So, Ron, going from where you guys started in 2003 to now, what's the trip been like? How has it grown? What's happened?
Well, it's been quite an adventure for us, but a lot of the needs have not really changed. The sniper units only have so much money, so once that money runs out, the guys are doing without. So we're still providing things, mostly sniper-specific gear, like rangefinders, spotting scopes, rifle scopes, gun cleaning gear, binoculars, that kind of thing. And it's the type of gear, like Dave said, when guys are getting deployed, they would call back home and they're asking mom and dad, hey, can you pick me up a wind meter? Well, folks don't generally know where to get that kind of stuff, but we do. So that's why they come to us, and we're able to get them their specific gear that they need.
Speaking with David Agata and Ron Sasaki with AmericanSnipers.org. All right, so you guys start this. It's a no-brainer to me. It's a great idea and a great service you're all doing. What's the reaction rolling this out in the sniper community?
We have, when people know what we're doing, all they want to do is help. And where they can help us is we raise money. We sell swag. We sell coins and little trinkets. People give and donate. The manufacturers will donate, but for the most part, people hear about it and they go, that's awesome. I'm upset we have to do that, but yeah, we want to help them.
Yeah, and it's funny you mentioned that, David. Ron, what do you guys think about, and I don't want to get political, but what do you think about that? It's got to be frustrating to officers to know that sometimes they can't get the support they need to get the equipment that they need.
I don't think that's ever going to change. I think as long as we have a bureaucracy that has budgets and budgets get tight, we're not going to always be able to get the things we need. We know that as police officers. We know that as the military. There's priorities. And the bottom line is, as American citizens, we're going to support our military. And when people recognize that and we can broad stroke share that, they want to be part of that.
That's cool. Once again, speaking with David Agata and Ron Sasaki with AmericanSnipers.org, you know, there's a lot of folks who don't understand what it is, the mindset, the mentality, the life of a sniper, whether it's a military or police. Ron, what can you tell people about how can they understand best what you guys are, what you go through, you know, help get inside your head?
Well, it's just a very specialized thing that we do. It's something that people volunteer for, but you also have to have the right mindset and the determination and the professionalism to go through that. It's not for everybody, and not everybody gets to do it, but it's a very special thing, and guys who earn that spot, we try and help them out by doing what we do.
All right, it's a big sacrifice. Normally, military police, you're sacrificing.
Right, so give us an idea of some of the people that you've helped and who've benefited from AmericanSnipers.org.
Out naming names, it's been hundreds of guys in all different branches of the service. So we're at events like this. We get approached by people and said, hey, in 2004, you sent us a bunch of gear. You really helped us out. We hear from parents, So that's what we get out of it. That's what we find fulfilling.
Gentlemen, I bet you that never gets old either, right?
No, not at all. Not at all. Not at all. And then some of the gear that we get or we get donated, we get to give that back to the manufacturers. We had a company that donated some knives.
Tell folks how they get more information about AmericanSnipers.org.
Well, you can go to our website at www.AmericanSnipers.org, and that's where they can donate. We always have gun raffles going on constantly of some pretty high-end guns that we get donated to us.
David, Ron, thanks for what you do, and thanks for being part of NRA News.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you so much for joining us here on this edition of NRA News, Cam and Company. Sponsored by Nosler, we have the Hero of the Day, sponsored by Adcore Defense, Deal of the Day, Good Guy of the Day, coming up top of the hour right now. I want to welcome to the program our friend from the American Spectator, Mr. Jed Babin. Jed, how you doing, sir?
Well, not bad for an old guy. How are you?
I am good. I appreciate you coming on the program today. It's always nice when we're referring a story whose title I can't actually say, Obama's Libya bleep show, which does, in fact, pretty much sum up his foreign policy legacy. You know, this is the president himself who said that his guiding principle was basically don't do stupid bleep, right?
Well, yeah, and of course, that's what he's done consistently. And quite frankly, the title, which we can't mention, I mean, those are his words, not
yes.
mine. So it's really a very interesting analysis that we have to go into to try to figure out, because the administration, Obama, never wants to take responsibility for anything. He's now blaming the mess in Libya on David Cameron, the UK's prime minister. And, you know, he said, oh, well, he took the eye off the ball, yada, yada, yada. And the fact of the matter is, this mess would never have existed if Obama didn't agree to do a military intervention in Libya, help overthrow the government. I mean, France and Britain, the two countries that really wanted to do it, had no means to do it. They don't have the power projection, the force projection that we do. And Obama said, yeah, okay, we can do that. And, well, you got the result you got right now, which is that Libya, which is a pretty doggone big country, is a safe haven for terrorists. And its entire country is taken over that way.
Yeah, I mean, it is a failed state at this point. And you know, so as you say, Britain and France didn't have the military footprint to go in and affect regime change. We did, but what we didn't have, Jed, it seems like, was a plan on what to do after Gaddafi was toppled, right?
Well, more importantly, but before we get to that, pardon me, I think the real point we have to make is that we had no national security interest in doing it. You know, there are places where we have to do things like that,
mm-hmm.
and we haven't done them, well, in quite a few years. But the basic point here is we had no national security interest, no vital national security interest that would compel us to do what we did. Obama made it up. He basically said, well, we've got a moral imperative to go in there, keep Gaddafi from massacring his people. And he said, well, this is a, quote, necessary, unique, and limited, end quote, action. Well, it wasn't necessary. It certainly isn't unique. And it was limited basically because he went in long enough to do damage and certainly did not stay long enough to try to settle things when the military action was over.
So, as you say, the reason for this was the danger of a humanitarian catastrophe. Jed, is it fair to call Libya a humanitarian catastrophe right now?
Well, I think it sure is. If you look at what's going on there, people are dying every day. The terrorists are running riot. ISIS has a massive safe haven there. They're running several of the cities. And, yeah, it's a humanitarian catastrophe. Libya, don't forget, is one of the sources of the mass of refugees that are going into Europe right now. So that's all part and parcel of the same thing. And, yes, absolutely, it's a humanitarian catastrophe.
We've got a few months left here in the Obama administration. Hillary Clinton obviously wants to run as I think it's fair to say, a third term of the Obama administration when it comes to foreign policy. Do you think that Hillary has done anything at all to distance herself from her role in the Libya catastrophe and B, the administration's philosophy when it came to Libya?
Well, she kind of played her, you know, hedged her bets when they were going into Libya. And ever since then, and particularly after the Benghazi disaster, which she is directly or indirectly responsible for, because she did not provide the security those people needed. She did not get them out before the incident occurred. And quite frankly, according to the Senate Select Committee on Investigations, the report they issued about 2 years ago, the fact of the matter was they knew. Hillary should have known. The State Department knew. The White House knew. There were 10 active terrorist groups working within the town limits of Benghazi before that attack. So they had a big role there. They have really just tried to cover things up, and we're going to see that more in the campaign after she's nominated. I'm hoping and praying that we're finally going to get a report from the Trey Gowdy Committee that will really explode some of this stuff in her face.
Well, let's hope. Listen, Jed, I appreciate you coming on the program, sir. It is always a pleasure getting a chance to talk with you. You had a chance to get out to the range, do any shooting lately?
Yes, actually, went out on Saturday and shot a round of 100 clays and did a little pistol work after that. It was great. Wish you could be there. We really just got to get you out there sometime.
I know. Well, especially, winter is over. I know it's coming if you're a Game of Thrones fan, but it is over here in Virginia. So hopefully I'll be able to get out and do a little bit more traveling, but I would love to get up there. Where do you shoot clays?
Well, my club, the place I belong to, is called Prospect Hall. It's out past Berryville, Virginia, out there. And, you know, you got my phone number. I know that. You got my email. I know that, too. So just, give me a call, give me an email, and invite yourself, for heaven's sake. I'd love to have you out there.
All right, we will do it. Jed, thank you as always, sir. We'll talk again soon.
Thanks, pal.
Jed Babin joins us from the American Spectator here on NRA News, Cam and Company. I am going to be going up to the NRA range here in a few days. We're going to take Julie Gunlock and some of the women from the Independent Women's Forum out there. So make sure you look for that here on NRA News, Cam and Company, before long. And coming up next hour, Hero of the Day, sponsored by AdCorps Defense, our Deal of the Day, Good Guy of the Day as well. We've been talking about Campus Carry down in Georgia. But, you know, this is an issue, campus safety, all around the country. One of the latest stories, St. Cloud, Minnesota, was Saturday night. Robbery happening near the campus of St. Cloud University. 20-year-old woman, a 19-year-old man, both from St. Cloud, walking down the street when two men confronted them and asked for their belongings, according to WJON. One of the men had a handgun. The other had a stun gun. The 19-year-old victim struggled with one of the suspects. The suspect did use his stun gun on the victim. Police found these suspects with the weapons and the victim's belongings, trying to cross 9th Avenue South at 5th Street, right there by the campus. 18-year-old Blake Dearmond of St. Cloud, 28-year-old Brandon Wilkes of Golden Valley, taken to the Stearns County Jail, where they're facing charges of first-degree aggravated robbery. 28-year-old Brandon Wilkes also had a warrant out for his arrest on aggravated robbery charges. Man, maybe we need another gun control law there. Maybe that's the answer. Or, I don't know, maybe the answer is to ensure that criminals have the false assumption, if they do still have that assumption, that students, faculty members are going to be defenseless victims as long as you can catch them on or near a college campus. But these stories, again, they happen all the time, all around the country. Meanwhile, we have a professor from Kennesaw State University who was arrested on Friday in the Georgia Capitol for protesting campus carry. Amy Donahue, an assistant professor of philosophy, was arrested for disruption of the General Assembly and obstruction of an officer for holding a 22-by-28-inch sign opposing the legislation. She was allowed to enter the Georgia State Capitol with her sign, visited an additional floor before she was arrested. The Morning News in Savannah, Georgia, reported that groups routinely bring signs into the building. Donahue's arrest angered the Georgia First Amendment Foundation, whose executive director, Holly Mannheimer, said in a statement, "It appears the citizen was trying to express herself, but instead was arrested." Law enforcement operated under a criminal statute, even though there seems to have been no evidence that the citizen was obstructing the hallway or any area at all with the intent to cause disruption. Well, we'll see what happens there at a trial. Donahue charged with two misdemeanors, released on a $2,000 bond. Spokesperson from Kennesaw State, by the way, said, "We have the utmost respect for the General Assembly, and while we support appropriate expressions of opinion, we do not condone the disruptive activities associated with this incident." So maybe Kennesaw State, the authorities there, know a little bit more about what actually took place there in the Capitol. As I understand it, and I am not a Georgia resident, but as I understand it, there are some areas of the Capitol building that are off limits to signs such as that. Meanwhile, Channel 11 in Georgia, talking to students there in Athens about a letter that has been sent to Governor Nathan Deal urging the governor veto the bill. Elaine Saunders is a senior at the University of Georgia. And she says, adding guns on campus carried by young adults will not make us any safer. The good guy with a gun theory is clearly a fallacy. Just look at what happened in a Detroit Home Depot last May. A woman decided to take it upon herself to open fire on someone who had been shoplifting. Since when is shoplifting a crime punishable by death? Elaine Saunders says it has been made clear by the vote yesterday of the Georgia State Senate that the feelings and beliefs of the constituents do not matter on this topic. What will it take to make it clear that this is a dangerous decision? How many students will have to be put in danger, she says. And do you think Elaine Saunders, I think she's aware of the armed citizen stories around the country? Those concealed carry holders coming to their own defense and defense of others? If not, we've got a story like that for you coming up at the top of the hour. Also, the deal of the day, good guy of the day, and much more. So stick around. Hour 3 of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, is coming up next.
It's truly an honor here to have Taya Kyle here. Taya, you walked through this this SHOT Show, and the people, like, as you were coming here to our set, you're stopped, like, every 5 feet. People just want your picture. They want to talk to you. But you were recently part of the CNN town hall on guns, and you asked the first question of the president, so I'm sure a lot of people who didn't know who you were now know who you were. You know the power of CNN, of course. Did you get mostly a positive or a negative reaction from people who've never heard of you before?
That's a good question. I haven't, if they felt negatively, and I'm sure there are plenty who did, I haven't heard from them, and I don't know if it's because I'm not out there looking for the negative comments necessarily,
right,
or if it's because the people who feel negatively haven't wanted to necessarily come up and talk to me.
Yeah.
I did get, right after the show was over, there were some people who came up and very respectfully were very kind, yeah, but kind of told me their views on their loved one that had died, and that right, they felt maybe a different form of background check would have helped more, and they were open to having a small dialogue about it, and I was glad for that, because I think that's part of the problem, is that there isn't enough respectful dialogue of both anybody's opinion. Can we not just talk about it and not be hateful about it?
Yeah. You know, you're here at the shooting industry trade show. Your husband was associated with shooting, of course, American Sniper. He was killed by a gun that is represented here at the show. Do women and people go up to you and say, how can you support an industry that led to the death of your husband? And what do you say back to them?
Well, it's an interesting thing. Like, you know, as you said, a gun that killed my husband, right? It wasn't the gun.
Right.
And it was the person. And I know that sometimes people feel like that's a trite difference. But I've gone over and over it in my mind. And I think you do that anytime you lose somebody you love. And I think the Chris's and Chad's case, Chad was killed with Chris, is a little bit different in that this is a person who was an armor. The murderer was an armor in the military. He had access to guns all the time and never killed anyone. When he got out and started making different life decisions, and I think from what I heard in the trial, it's my opinion, he was enabled a lot and has been seen as the victim a lot. But yeah, the biggest thing was that he got out of a lot of trouble by claiming PTSD. And the police would say, okay, well, let's take you to a mental facility instead of taking you to jail. And then they would. In the mental facility, they didn't see any PTSD. What they saw was something other than psychosis, which is kind of a term for drug use. And they would release him because they couldn't talk to the police because of HIPAA laws. I wish they could have said, hey, look, this guy claimed that he had PTSD. That's a legit disease, but that's not what this person has, or a disorder, a temporary disorder situation that you have. So I think we could go to that, and we could also go in Chris's and Chad's instance in particular. His mother, Chris, talked to his mother, and from my understanding, said, would your son like to go to a shooting range? And she said, oh, yes, and didn't explain. What we also learned in trial was that a few months before, he had threatened to kill himself and his whole family, so they had the guns removed from their home.
Right.
And so I don't want to be too long-winded, but I do want to get to that point for you, because I think that's at the root of it. Would Chris have helped him? Yes. But would he have taken him to a shooting range? No. There was information he didn't have. And it wasn't that he had PTSD, because PTSD, people don't typically, I mean, I don't know that I know of any cases where they've murdered someone because of that. They've hurt themselves, but not murdered someone else. So there was no threat that Chris could have known. I can also tell you that this person, and I think this is true of a lot of people who murder, that it's not as often a crime of passion. This person thought about killing Chris and Chad on the drive down. He didn't do it because he didn't want to get hurt. At least that's what he said in some of the testimony. And so he waited until their guns were empty. He waited until they weren't looking, right? And so I think that if you boil that all down into all these situations, how do we identify the person who has the ability to murder? Because the gun owners I know, and I know quite a few of them, the human heart is not built to murder.
Welcome back. Hour 3 of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, starts right now. Tim Lee with the Center for Individual Freedom join us later on in the hour. John Cardillo, host of the John Cardillo Show, talking about the latest attacks on our law enforcement around the country. Also, a new survey of cops in New York City indicates that these police officers are very unhappy with the way things are going. New York Post reporting, poll of more than 6,000 of the NYPD's roughly 24,000 rank and file revealed a resounding lack of passion for the job, with cops on average rating morale at just 2.49 on a scale of 1 to 10. Roughly 87% of officers said the Big Apple has become, quote, less safe since the new administration took over. The de Blasio administration took over at the beginning of 2014. 55% of those respondents, again, New York police officers, say that the city has become, quote, a lot less safe. 96% of cops say the relationships between officers and the communities that they patrol have gotten worse during the same period. 89% of officers polled said that they would quit the NYPD if they were offered a higher-paying job in law enforcement. 86% said they would not recommend the job to family members. Again, we'll talk about the results of this survey with John Cardillo coming up a little bit later on in the hour. More news from law enforcement, this time out in California. The Sacramento Bee reporting that the California Sheriff's Association has come out in opposition to Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom's big gun control referendum push. Christopher Catalago with the Sacramento Bee says that California sheriffs say the proposals would place additional restrictions on law-abiding people who want to buy ammunition for recreational use, retain firearms and magazines that are currently legal, or pass down historical or family heirlooms. President Martin Ryan, the Amador County Sheriff, and the chair of the California State Sheriff's Association PAC, Gregory Ahern, the sheriff of Alameda County, wrote, effectively, this measure will create a new class of criminals out of those that already comply with common sense practices that now exist. The focus of efforts to reduce gun violence in the state should be on those responsible for that violence, not those that have no intent to do harm. You know, again, that kind of sums up where the anti-gun movement is right now in this country, right? We've talked about this before. Cast that net as wide as possible over as many law-abiding gun owners as possible. And maybe trapped in that net, you'll get a couple of criminals. But you know who's you're going to get caught in that net are a bunch of law-abiding gun owners. You are further restricting and narrowing the legal exercise of the right to keep and bear arms when you continually push legislation that is aimed at the law-abiding legal gun owners. And that's exactly what these proposals by Gavin Newsom do, requiring ammunition background checks for every ammunition purchase, banning magazines over 10 rounds. Even if you've already owned them, you've owned them for years in California, no longer would you be able to possess them. The Sacramento Bee says, while California has some of the nation's most restrictive firearms policies, including a 1999 ban on quote-unquote assault weapons, it would expand that prohibition to high-capacity magazines over 10 rounds, grandfathered in by the law. If it passes, the owners would need to sell them to a licensed dealer who, again, couldn't sell them, right? Transfer them out of state or turn them into law enforcement to be disposed of. Again, very, very similar to what the city of Los Angeles has done at the local level. And what happened when the city of Los Angeles passed that local ordinance that said, listen, you're not allowed to own these magazines anymore. You either have to get them out of here, you have to turn them into us, but you can't keep them. Not one magazine was turned in to the LAPD. Not one. Meanwhile, by the way, violent crime is up in Los Angeles this year. You know, the city council is focused on things like this ordinance. If you've been a legal owner of these magazines, you can't own them anymore. If you are a legal handgun owner in Los Angeles, you have to have that firearm locked up at all times in your house unless it is on your person or under your immediate control. Again, efforts aimed at law-abiding legal gun owners. Meanwhile, violent crime is increasing in Los Angeles. And the lawmakers don't want to talk about that. They don't want to direct their efforts at those who are actually committing violent crimes. Hillary Clinton is the same way at the national level. At her CNN town hall style event last night, the Democratic Party's town hall style event. Telling that questioner, what are you going to do? What programs are you going to put in place to reduce gang-related violence? Well, let me give you a couple of gun control laws that I'd like to see implemented, Hillary said. Let me tell you what I'd like to do to the legal law-abiding gun owners in this country to make life a little bit more difficult for them. When the question was, what are you going to do to reduce gang-related violence? Let's talk about what we're going to do to the law-abiding instead. All right, let's talk about our hero of the day, our deal of the day, and our good guy of the day. Hero of the day, sponsored by AdCorp Defense. We had Michael Graham reference this story. He said, I'm sure you've already talked about it. That's because Michael didn't realize that we do our Hero of the Day in Hour 3, but we'll talk about it anyway. Out in Seattle, Washington, Q13, the Fox affiliate, with the story of a concealed carry holder at a 7-Eleven there in Seattle, who was talking with the clerk there at 7-Eleven when an individual walked in carrying a hatchet. He took a swing at the concealed carry holder, missed, thankfully, and then took a swing at the clerk there behind the counter, slightly injuring the clerk. Thankfully, the customer there in White Center, Washington, did have his firearm. He's a concealed carry holder. And the customer was able to fire his pistol and hit the suspect. Medics arrived shortly after, according to Q13. And the attacker was pronounced dead at the scene. Again, King County Sheriff's investigators, according to Fox 13, say the customer who shot the man appears to have done nothing wrong. And they're happy he was there to intervene. King County Sheriff Sergeant Cindy West said, fortunately, because of this customer with his weapon, this could have been a lot worse. The clerk could be the one laying there dead on the floor right now. But because this individual, who's a concealed carry holder, was there, the clerk is alive. The clerk there at 7-Eleven, a 58-year-old Seattle man, says the customer, a 60-year-old Seattle man, is a regular at the store, visits it daily. Said the customer's a nice guy. Been coming in for about 12 years or so. Buys coffee, buys scratch tickets. Investigators say the area is a quiet neighborhood, say that this is the first violent incident at the store in recent memory. And hopefully it will be the last violent incident at that store for a long time to come. But thankfully, again, there was an individual there who could put a stop to that attack. And that 60-year-old man, you know, he might not have been able to do so had he been barehanded. Maybe he could have thrown his a coffee in the face of that hatchet-wielding maniac. Maybe we'll even hear some anti-gun activists say that's what should have happened. But the King County Sheriff's Department investigator sure seems glad that that man had his concealed carry license and had his firearm on him. All right, now I also mentioned we had an update to an armed citizen story from last week. News on 6 in Tulsa, Oklahoma, with an update. You remember the story out of Midwest City, Oklahoma, an 18-year-old woman said that she had shot and killed her ex-boyfriend after he broke into her home. Well, now Police Chief Brandon Claves there in Midwest City says the woman has admitted that her current boyfriend fired the shot that killed 20-year-old Isaiah Orange. Brandon Claves says that Orange did break into the home early last Thursday. He was armed with a gun, and he did threaten to kill not just the ex-girlfriend, but the ex-girlfriend's current boyfriend. He then began assaulting the woman, and that is when the current boyfriend pulled a gun from beneath a pillow and shot Isaiah Orange. Now, Brandon Claves says the couple told police that they lied because they feared retribution from Orange's family or friends. Chief Claves says that the shooting still appears to be self-defense. No charges are expected, although the case will be given to the district attorney for review. And, you know, I guess I can understand concern about retribution, but you got to be honest with the police because they're going to learn sooner or later. So it's very important you tell police what happened there, particularly when you're being questioned by them. Either that or, you know, you're going to possibly be facing charges of perjuring yourself when you're talking to authorities if you're not truthful with them. But an update for you on that armed citizen story. It looks like it is still an armed citizen story, just a little bit different than what was originally reported. Now, our deal of the day. We're going to have a lot of deals of the day today. Talked about the father of Tyshawn Lee, held in Chicago, the 9-year-old who was murdered back in the fall. Tyshawn Lee's father now held on the shooting of 3 individuals over the weekend, 25-year-old, again, with a lengthy criminal history. But I saw this story out of the Duluth News Tribune. William James Holiski II. They write he has a criminal record replete with assaultive and threatening behavior towards women. Back in 2006, he served a 3-year prison sentence after firing several shots into an ex-girlfriend's home in Duluth. A few years before that, he burglarized another ex's residence. In 2007, he pleaded guilty to threatening an 83-year-old neighbor. And more recently, they report, he was convicted of assaulting a female corrections officer en route to a court appearance in Virginia. All this was on his record. All this was known to those working in the criminal justice system. In early 2015, when Holiski went before the court, and it was actually found to have intentionally violated the conditions of his probation in a domestic assault case. He was under court supervision after being convicted of repeatedly hitting and kicking his girlfriend during a dispute. He failed to report to a court-ordered domestic abuse program. But even though he violated his probation, and he was eligible for additional prison time, he was eligible for maybe even increased supervision while on probation, 6th Judicial District Judge Mark Munger there in Minnesota took a different approach, according to the Duluth News Tribune. Holiski had already served more than 2/3 of a 21-month sentence. So even though he violated his probation, the judge removed Holiski from supervised probation. Mm-hmm. Just took him off and put him on unsupervised probation instead, where he would no longer be subject to frequent contact with a probation officer. That was January of 2015. The Duluth News Tribune says less than 4 months later, authorities say Holiski fatally stabbed Lisa Jean Isham inside her Lincoln Park home. 4 months. He, by the way, if he had just stayed on supervised probation, he would have still been on probation. The Duluth News Tribune says it was a series of events that raised eyebrows within the local legal community. Several officials in the criminal justice system who spoke to the News Tribune under the condition of anonymity because they appear before the judge says the outcome underscores flaws in the system that allow violent criminals to reoffend. Alisky, one attorney with knowledge of Alisky's criminal record, says, I've never seen anything like this. With his history of violence, it seems like the message was not sent. You know, with all due respect, I bet that this attorney, if he thought long and hard enough, I bet he has seen something like this before. I bet he's seen many cases like this before. So the 63-year-old Alisky is once again before the judge. The judge is presiding over his second-degree intentional murder case, which is set to go before the court in July. It was January 2013. Alisky, charged with felony domestic assault. His then-girlfriend reported to believe she was repeatedly struck and kicked during an argument. She told police that Alisky, who had lived with her for about 2 months, backhanded her across the face 3 or 4 times. When another man in the apartment intervened, he forcibly shoved the man out of the apartment and locked the door. The victim then reported that Alisky knocked her to the ground, began kicking her and stomping on her foot. Alisky pleaded not guilty to the charge. He was convicted by a St. Louis County jury on September 19th, 2014. Again, it was August 2006. He fired 2 shots at the home of a woman that he had met online and dated for a few months. The woman and her son were both in the home, but they weren't struck. He pled guilty to second-degree assault in 2008 and was sentenced to 3 years, or served a 3-year sentence. At that point, he was already a felon, so I don't know why he wasn't convicted, or I guess the gun charge was probably dropped in the plea bargain. Since he could have had a felon in possession charge, but instead it was second-degree assault. Well, the Duluth News Tribune says that Alisky, again, could have been sentenced to prison. And if the judge had executed the prison sentence, Alisky would have been sent to and immediately discharged from the Department of Corrections. According to attorneys who reviewed a case for the News Tribune, Minnesota law requires that 2/3 of a sentence be spent in prison, with the remaining portion served as supervised release. So if the judge had said, all right, you got to go back to prison for violating your probation, attorneys are saying, well, because of the amount of time that he'd already served, he would have been sent right back out onto the streets anyway, under supervised probation. Instead, the judge, quote, vacated all of the terms and conditions of Alisky's original sentence, which had him on supervised probation through October of 2016. The judge placed him on unsupervised status and shortened the probationary term to January of 2016. Paper says the handling of Alisky's probation violation might remain a hot topic in legal circles, but those involved in the case had little to say publicly. The assistant state's attorney cited the ongoing case. Alisky's defense attorney did not respond to a request for comment. The judge didn't want to talk about it either. One local attorney interviewed for the story pointed to flaws in the system that prevented a harsher sentence for a defendant with a troubling history. The attorney who requested anonymity to speak candidly said this guy with his record is still not a prison commit. Why are so many drug dealers and users in prison and this guy is not? How many times do you have to shoot at people and attack people before you do hard time? Well, again, it seems to me that you can do all kinds of stuff, as long as your crimes don't end up on the front page of the paper, they don't end up leading the nightly newscast, this is likely what is going to happen to you as a career criminal. You are going to get opportunity after opportunity, yes, to change your ways, but you're also going to get opportunity after opportunity to reoffend. And until those crimes reach a level that they lead the nightly news, that they are above the fold on the front page of the paper, nothing is likely to change. All right, when we return after a quick timeout here on this edition of NRA News Cam and Company, Mr. Tim Lee joins us from the Center for Individual Freedom for this week's Liberty Update. Stick around. We have much more NRA News Cam and Company coming up, sponsored by Nosler, right after this. Welcome on set, our friend Melissa Bachman, the host of Deadly Passion on Sportsman Channel. Melissa, how are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me.
It is my pleasure. I wish I could be there in person, but unfortunately the winter weather is not cooperating with us. So tell me, what's going on in your world? What are you working on in 2016?
Well, right now I just got started on Season 5, and I'm really excited about this season. We've been on the air for quite a while now, Season 5, but one thing that I actually brought that's brand new that I've been trying to brainstorm for several years is a new segment called Memory Chase, and that's all about trying to get more kids involved. And the reason I did it is I wanted viewers at home to have a chance to send in their kids' footage. I remember when I was little, I used to look through our outdoor news newspaper and look for photos of other kids and then always want to submit mine. So it's kind of the same idea. So what I'm doing is about a minute and a half segment for those kids who get picked, and then their footage can be on TV. They get a huge prize pack. Just a really good way to get more kids involved.
Oh, that's really, really cool. And again, I mean, reaching back to your own childhood, we know that, look, we know that bringing kids into the world of the outdoors is critical. And it's not just critical for the industry. It's critical for the next generation. You know, I as a father of five, I want my kids to understand that there is a world beyond the TV screen and their tablet. You know, I want them to get out and enjoy the great outdoors. And unless we actually help them, you know, I don't think they're going to do that. The TV's right there. The tablet's right there. It's so much easier to just stay on the couch, but it's so much better to actually get outside.
Absolutely. And what I'm trying to do is really bridge that gap. You do have so many kids on YouTube. You've got them online. You've got them watching the television shows. So use that medium to get them outside. So that's kind of been the idea behind it. I also know we don't have to give kids prizes for everything, but it doesn't hurt either. So a new bow, all sorts of great stuff. Plus they get to see themselves on TV. We've had a lot of submissions since it started. The first five were amazing. It's just really neat for anybody to see that real reaction from the kids, and it makes, you know, other adults excited and kind of reminds us to do our part as well to get out there and to bring kids along.
Speaking with Dan Caporelli with Hire Our Heroes. Dan, welcome to NRA News. Tell us, what is Hire Our Heroes?
Yeah, so Hire Our Heroes is a nonprofit organization that basically helps transitioning veterans to position themselves for employment as they get out of the service.
Why'd you start this, Dan?
I served in the Marine Corps Reserves, and after 8 years, I got out thinking I had this great skill set. I was a satellite communications specialist, and shortly thereafter, long story short, there was really no opportunity for me to really find employment or anybody to help me find employment. So I felt like I was on an island by myself, and I thought if hey, I couldn't be the only veteran going through this, that there was probably a need for a greater reach. And lo and behold, I gathered a few other veterans, and we formed Hire Our Heroes, basically founded by veterans for veterans.
That is great. So what's the reaction been to Hire Our Heroes?
You know, it's been phenomenal. It's one of those things, be careful what you wish for. The response has been overwhelming at times, but it has been nothing short of great and rewarding at the same time. There's nothing but opportunity for us to help veterans. And believe it or not, there's a lot of nonprofits out there, and these veterans still have a tough time really finding the right one that's going to bring them down the path to success as they transition out.
Dan,
we feel like we've got a pretty cool tool set to do that.
Awesome. Dan Caporelli with Hire Our Heroes. How can folks get more information about the great work you're doing and your great organization?
Visit us on the web at hireourheroes.org, and they can fill out information on whether or not they're interested in transitioning, reaching for somebody to reach out for them to connect, as well as some of our other services and that we offer.
Dan Caporelli, thanks for what you're doing, and thanks for being on NRA News. Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company. Cam Edwards, your host. Thank you so much for being a part of the program today. Still to come, Mr. John Cardillo, host of The John Cardillo Show, talking about the attacks on law enforcement over the weekend, plus a new poll shows a very demoralized New York Police Department. Right now, I want to welcome to the program from the Center for Individual Freedom, Mr. Tim Lee joins us. Tim, how are you, sir?
Doing well. Hope you guys all had a good weekend.
You know, it wasn't too bad. It was nice and spring-like. It wasn't, you know, 85, 90 degrees like you have out there in the West, but it wasn't bad at all. I'll take it. So, yes.
This is where we pivot between those days where I can sort of gloat and say, boy, you know, hate to apologize for the weather out here, but it's 75 and sunny when you're sort of snowed in back there. We're at that pivot point now where, yeah, it starts getting up toward the triple digits here, and you can gloat because you've got cherry blossoms coming out and the spring and the flowers. Fortunately, I'll be out there in a couple weeks, so I guess I can see it. But at any rate, this is your opportunity for the next few months now to start rubbing it in on me, I guess.
Exactly. I have lots of friends who live out in Arizona. It's a wonderful place. My wife hates the geography of Arizona. She thinks it just looks like Mars. I think there is a stark beauty to Arizona, so I actually like it. It's a heck of a lot different than Virginia, but I do enjoy gloating to my friends when it's, you know, 118 degrees in Phoenix and they have to get in their car at the end of a work day. I do enjoy telling them it's only like 90 degrees here in Virginia.
I will say this, and it's not rationalization because I'm sort of at the disadvantage for the next few months, but I will say this, you know, before I moved out to D.C., the only cities where I'd lived were Phoenix and Los Angeles up until about 10 years ago, and I really braced myself for the winters out there. You know, I stocked up on coats. I moved out in June of 2006, but, you know, I sort of wondered, you know, how bad is it going to be when it's snowing, and I've never dealt with this before. I'll tell you that the tougher adjustment was actually the summers out there because it's so dry in Phoenix and Los Angeles that I think my first day there I wore a dress shirt and tie and suit. And I lasted about 3 minutes before I looked like I'd just stepped out of a shower wearing full clothes. And I realized at that point you buy only non-iron dress shirts anymore. I haven't bought a regular cotton dress shirt since. The humidity in the summers were actually the tougher adjustment out there. But, you know, I can understand your wife. I wanted to get out of the desert badly. I hated the topography here when I was a kid. After leaving it, I started to appreciate it. But I don't think your wife is crazy. A lot of people feel that way.
All right, so I got to ask you too, since I haven't really asked you this question since you've moved back out west. But you know, Arizona is a constitutional carry state. Are you in fear of your life, Tim, every time you leave the house? Are you more concerned about the people around you than you were when you were living in the D.C. area?
Yeah, I'll tell you this. I don't have to set an alarm clock anymore here in the Phoenix area because you awaken to gunshots. I mean, right outside your door on a daily basis.
Yeah.
You feel totally unsafe even driving with your kids down to the store. It's, you know, these nuts with their, you know, revolvers strapped to their legs. Sometimes they shoot at you just because they don't like the color of your car. No, I'm obviously being facetious here. I'll tell you this, you know, it's not a shock to me because I've lived a total of 25 years here growing up and then through college and then a couple years in the late 90s. And I will say this though, that my better half is shocked how nice people are out here. Maybe I just became accustomed to it. They do say a well-armed society is a polite society. I don't think that's why they're nice out here. I don't think anybody fears that, you know, inside your cargo pants that you're carrying. I will say this, though, that, you know, certainly compared, you know, I was in Old Town, and so, you know, that wasn't really ever scary. But, I got to tell you, when you're going through a place like Texas or Arizona, you feel much better. And I haven't paid close attention to it, but I used to take the Metro a lot. And you just hear people getting on the Red Line, especially. I don't know what it is about the Red Line, but near Metro Center or Chinatown, and just mob attacks nowadays where people just decide to pounce on somebody, maybe take their phone. I know over 4th of July, somebody got killed. Look, let's face it. You know, we can the other side will argue on and on that that the problem is guns, but do you think any one of those people who assaults others on a metro has any fear whatsoever that the person they're assaulting is carrying? You try that out here, and you know whether you're coming up on a guy in a car or something else, people are at least going to think twice about it out here. And you know, it's a lot of it is anecdotal, but a lot of it is borne out by the actual data and evidence, as you know, and as we talk about on this show a lot, and as people like John Lott have detailed in studies. But no, to answer your question in a very simple way, I think you do get just a sense of greater security out here. Although I will say that, again, I lived in Virginia, and
sure.
So, you know, when you were out there, it felt a little bit better than if you were perhaps up in D.C. where they're completely banned. But yeah, I mean, I'm less frightened to go on a freeway here or on the light rail that they have here than I would have been sort of, you know, going to a Nationals game, maybe in on the Yellow Line and going through Chinatown where some of these assaults have happened. Absolutely.
Yeah, it's interesting. And just, you know, as far as crime stats go, I realize, you know, it might be a little bit apples and oranges comparing the state of Arizona to the District of Columbia. But Arizona in 2014, you guys had the lowest violent crime rate since 1970. 399 point violent, 399 violent crimes for 100,000 people. District of Columbia, meanwhile, had 1,244 violent crimes per 100,000 people. So all things considered, about three times more violent crime per capita than the state of Arizona.
Yeah, it's. I'll say that a lot of people, just you know, soccer moms driving around out here, you don't get that sense of fear. You know, right before I moved back in January, too, I remember there was a story in Georgetown. And anybody listening who's been to Georgetown in the D.C. area knows it's a very, very upscale area. The equivalent out here in Phoenix would be perhaps Paradise Valley or Scottsdale. And there was some story about a mother, I think you may have talked about it on your show, a mother who barely escaped in her SUV. I think it had a sunroof, and some mob, just for whatever reason, decided to follow her to her car. She got into the car at just the last moment where she could get away, and they had her car surrounded. People were climbing out. I want to say that maybe one guy climbed up and sort of kicked in the sunroof or something like that, and for no reason, apparently. You know, I have never heard about that in Phoenix, ever. That's not to say that there isn't crime. You just detailed that it often, or it obviously exists here too, but I have never heard of something like that. Whereas in D.C., you know, it was becoming more and more frequent. D.C. was the place, and I suspect you've talked about this on your show as well, where multiple Marine veterans were assaulted. I think it was in Chinatown as well, at a McDonald's, wasn't it, where the Marine was just beaten senseless with a sucker punch from behind by these kids who came up to him and were demanding that he say that he agreed with Black Lives Matter. Black Lives Matter. You know, they had the film of it where these guys just follow him out the door and he's walking away. He's not even facing them. And some guy just sucker punches him, knocks him out. The other guys rob him and keep kicking him while he's on the ground. This is a U.S. Marine. I want to say this is about a month ago.
Yeah.
And that sort of thing happens there.
Yeah, it does, unfortunately. And, you know, it got, I guess, quite a bit of local attention, but it never really rose to the level of a national story, I guess, because it's, you know, it's a local crime story in D.C. There are no shortages, unfortunately, of local crime stories there.
Well, and you've been to plenty of NRA conventions, and I can't think it's coincidence that none have ever been attacked. You know, wrong place to come in and try to shoot up the place, right? I've never heard of somebody committing mass assault at an NRA convention. So I think that alone sort of proves the point as well, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, absolutely. As a matter of fact, you know, I think it was, I don't know what the crime stats were for Nashville, but I know when the NRA annual meeting was in town in Indianapolis 2 years ago, afterwards the police department said violent crime was down 20% in the downtown area. Compared to, I think, the average of the month before the NRA annual meeting was there. So that is not unusual, you know, when you have tens of thousands of law-abiding gun owners come to town, Tim, the criminals often find something else that they have to do that weekend. They got to get their nails done. They got to get their hair done, right? But they don't really have to commit a lot of muggings or armed robberies there on the street.
Not happening there. You know, if Rahm Emanuel were smart, he would be doing whatever he could to entice the NRA to move its headquarters from Fairfax, Virginia, to Chicago and host its conventions there free of charge, whether it's Soldier Field or, you know, the United Center where the Blackhawks or Bulls play.
Uh-huh.
Heck, even Wrigley Field, you know, just to spice it up a little bit. If Rahm Emanuel were smart, he would do something like that. You'd see crime plummet. You'd get the business of the NRA there. And, hey, I have nothing against Fairfax, but, you know, Mayor Emanuel, if you're listening, Give that some thought, maybe. Help your city out.
Yeah, I'm sure that's on his agenda. I'm sure he'll get right on that. Thankfully, there are at least some concealed carry holders in the city of Chicago these days. Unfortunately, you know, the mayor and anti-gun forces in Illinois have made it as difficult as possible, as difficult as they could make it anyway, to get their concealed carry license. But we are seeing. And even in some high crime neighborhoods, you're actually seeing some Chicagoans who are able to get their concealed carry license. And thank goodness for that. That's genuine progress.
Yeah, well, that was what the McDonald decision from 2010 was all about, following up the Heller decision of a couple years earlier. And that McDonald decision originated from Chicago. So
yep.
Proving your point.
Absolutely. All right. Well, listen, Tim, we got to rub it. I appreciate you coming on the program, sir. And folks can check out CFIF.org. You're updating the blog, and every day you've got new features there on the website, right?
Yeah, my piece last week was on IRS data. For anybody who either says or hears other people say that the wealthier Americans don't pay their fair share, the IRS data is out. Take a look at it, because they pay far more than what I think any reasonable person would consider their fair share. Just to give you one illustration, the top 1% in America earns about 19% of the nation's income, but they pay about 40% of the nation's income taxes. So that's twice as much. Anyway, there's a lot of data like that in there. It really rebuts that claim that the wealthy are just getting away with murder when it comes to taxes. If anything, the opposite's true.
All right, Tim, we'll check it out. Listen, I appreciate you coming on the program, sir. Enjoy your week, and we'll talk to you again very soon.
Everybody have a good one.
All right, Tim Lee joins from the Center for Individual Freedom. John Cardillo, host of the John Cardillo Show, joins us after a quick timeout. We're going to talk about the deadly weekend for law enforcement officers around the country, as well as a new poll of New York police officers showing a lot of dissatisfaction in the ranks there. Stick around. There is much more. NRA News Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, right after this. We're talking with Mike Strickhauser with the First Pennsylvania chapter of All Four Kids Hunting. And, Mike, thank you so much for coming on the program. It's good seeing you again.
Appreciate it. It's always fun up here.
And so you were telling me, I didn't have a chance to watch the ribbon cutting here at the Great American Outdoor Show, but you were there, and you said that there was a big check there, big oversized check. The NRA, this is one of the organizations that the NRA gave a grant to, right?
That's correct. They gave us a great donation this year, and it's all helping to put the kids out there where we need to go.
So what do you do there with All Four Kids Hunting? What's the mission?
Any kid that comes to us, regardless of whether they're handicapped or otherwise, we try to make sure that they all have an equal opportunity to get in the outdoors. And that could either be with hunting, fishing, just about anything. And we've had some great contacts here this week. As I told you this morning, we got a gentleman who brought his son in there who has, he was born premature. He has several surgeries that have been going on throughout, and now his kidney is starting to fail. And March 1st, he's going to be going on dialysis, and he wants to do an exotic hunt. And we just went down and talked to Island Exotics, who really support our programs, and told Steve with the situation and his little buddy with him, we got him a hunt too. One's going to take a hog, and of course, the little fella, he's going to take a ram.
That is awesome.
It's going to be.
So you all are working with outfitters and guides here in Pennsylvania.
That's correct.
And like you said, I mean, this isn't about just helping one kind of kid, but a lot of the kids that you see are kids with health problems?
Well, yeah, we do get a lot, but we also have a lot of single parents out there.
Okay.
You know, that we have a situation where ladies divorced, working two jobs, and her kid just loves to get in the outdoors. but she doesn't know how to go about it. And there's where we jump in, and we have different programs like our banquet where we meet and greet a lot of people. And this past banquet, we had some kids come in there. Any kid that comes to our banquet gets a ticket for a free hunt. This year, because I have a lodge up in the northern tier, I decided to take a gentleman for a bear hunt. 13 years old, has I wouldn't say a lot of handicaps, but he has some attention disorders.
Okay.
First time he's ever even seen a bear outside of Hershey Zoo or on TV.
Right.
Tuesday, shot himself a 186-pound boar. He could not have been any happier if you'd give him $1 million.
Wow.
And that's the kind of stuff that makes everything great. And like Steve told you this morning, you know, it's the look on their face when they actually get the chance to see an animal or even take an animal.
Right, absolutely.
But it's a hoot.
I can imagine. I mean, you know, it's one of those things where you're doing good, but you're feeling good as well. Oh. How long have you been doing this, Steve?
Actually, Mike? I've been involved with kids' programs since 2008.
Really?
Yeah.
And has the program grown over the past 8 years or so?
More than I ever thought it would.
Really?
I mean, every time we come here to Harrisburg, the response from the people is just overwhelming. I mean, you just can't. You have to come down and see. I mean, right now, I just left the booth to get here.
Yeah.
And we've got all kinds of kids coming in there. We have another boy that's coming to the banquet who just lost his dad a week ago to cancer.
Oh, my gosh.
And I knew there was something wrong when I looked at him because he wouldn't. And, you know, I'm giving him lollipops, you know, and he won't talk. And then we find out after we take him back and talk to him, he's with his uncle who has terminal cancer. This is the kind of stuff that just tears you up.
Yeah. I think the outdoor industry sometimes gets a bad rap, right? You've got people who don't hunt, who say, oh, you're just a bloodthirsty animal killer, yeah. Mike, right? But then you hear stories like this. And here's the thing. There is such a big heart within the outdoor community. I think there is no shortage of people who want to help and who are helping, you know, people who need it, whether it's kids like this, our wounded warriors.
Absolutely.
You know, but the heart that is on display within the community, just here in Harrisburg, I think is amazing.
And you see that, Cam. I know there isn't an outfitter in that hall over there that you couldn't walk up to, not just me, but anybody, and have a special needs kid there that they wouldn't try to help out. And I don't think there's any of them over there that don't respect that when this does happen, they don't have to kill.
Yeah.
It's the thrill of being out there and see an animal.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company. Sponsored by our friends at Nosler. Want to welcome to the program right now, host of the John Cardillo Show, Mr. John Cardillo. How you doing, John?
I'm doing great, Cam. How are you?
I am good. All right, so I want to talk to you about this poll that the New York Post reported on. Some 6,000 of the 24,000 rank and file in the NYPD talking about their job satisfaction. I also want to talk about the attacks that we saw on law enforcement this weekend, because I think the two may be somewhat related here. So they asked cops, rank on a scale of 1 to 10, where your morale is right now. And the average rating for a New York police officer who answered this poll, 2.49 on a scale of 1 to 10. So not even 2.5 on a scale of 1 to 10. Morale, John, it seems, in the NYPD is extraordinarily low right now. Vast majorities of officers say that they think crime has gotten worse under Bill de Blasio. 55% of those officers responding say that New York City is a lot less safe than it was just a couple of years ago. And they say that the relations between officers and the communities that they patrol have gotten worse during the same time period. Are you with us, John?
Sorry about that, Cam.
That's okay.
My phone hit mute.
Ah.
I'm surprised that it's 2.5. And I think that's because some cops probably voted higher, afraid that their results would get to a boss and they'd be fired. Look, the cops I talked to, not anecdotally, not people in passing, friends of mine that have been on the job 20-plus years, are telling me it's as bad as they've ever seen it. The problem number one is the de Blasio administration is essentially handpicking who they appoint to the higher level ranks. Now, in the New York City Police Department, anything above the rank of captain is an appointment, inspector, deputy, inspector, chief. So the mayor's office has tremendous weight in those decisions. De Blasio is looking for the most progressive, the furthest left from the ranks, and appointing them, and that's trickling down. So now these cops are being managed by people who mirror De Blasio's attitude on policing. So right there, the cops are at a disadvantage. When that happens and neighborhoods become less safe, the community turns on the police, because if the police can't protect the good residents, the people you and I always talk about, those people are afraid of the gangbangers and the criminals, and they start to align with them out of survival, out of preservation. And so De Blasio has really created that climate, but accelerated it in a way that even David Dinkins never did.
The one cop quoted by the New York Post says, morale is terrible. It's always been bad, but echoing exactly what you said, this is the worst that it has been. Even though Bratton stands up there and tells you we're not about numbers, we're not about summonses, that's a lot of BS. Meanwhile, a high-ranking NYPD official, spokesman Peter Donald, said that the survey highlights areas that need improvement. It is far from scientific and was likely answered by, quote, people on the extremes. Now, again, these are rank-and-file New York police officers. There were some 6,000 of them who answered this. And you could say, well, there were 20,000 officers. I got to tell you, John, 6,000 is a pretty good sample size for a survey here.
It's hyper-scientific, right? You've got about 35,000 in the NYPD. Figure that many of those are supervisors, detectives, and police officers, but in administrative roles. 6,000 is about 30% of the patrol force. I mean, it's an insanely scientific sample. So for him to say these are extremists, it's bizarre. It's simply bizarre. This is the same tone-deaf rhetoric, though, we've heard from De Blasio on the police since the day he took office. He's completely clueless as to how to protect the city and to how to build morale in the department.
Yeah, well, referring to these officers as just a bunch of cranks is not going to inspire these officers. As a matter of fact, I would think that would probably cause morale to plummet, because what it indicates, what it tells you is that here you have an administration that is not willing or able to take what these officers have to say seriously.
Well, right, and understand why that summons, the comment about being forced to write summonses and all, is so important, okay? Back when I worked there, they called it suggested activity. It was never called a quota, because the joke was the New York City Police Department doesn't have quotas. We have suggested activity. But it was 25 parking tickets, 10 moving violations, and three of those they wanted to be red lights. Now, you didn't have to write those tickets, but if you didn't write those summonses, you'd find yourself out of a car walking a footpost in the rain. And so that's how the New York City Police Department generates, forces you to do the revenue generation part of the job. And so these cops are spot on that's all this administration cares about, revenue generation, not crime prevention.
Talking again with John Cardillo, host of the John Cardillo Show. John, I mean, the cops that you talk to, according to this poll, 89% of cops polled said that they would quit the department if they were offered a higher paying job in law enforcement. 86% said they would not recommend the job to family members. Are a lot of these cops now just sort of waiting it out until they can retire if they've served a considerable amount of time on the force?
Yeah, waiting it. There's a couple of things they're doing. So, yes, if they've got, 15 or more years on where they could vest tomorrow, then they're waiting for their 20th year to retire. Guys with over 20 on are waiting for that 25th year to make a little more money. The younger guys and girls are applying to other departments, because right outside New York City, Westchester County, Nassau, Suffolk County, they pay considerably more than the NYPD. It's a much better quality of life on the job. You're appreciated by the community, your bosses. It's gotten so bad that New York City is now suing those cities to refund them money for an NYPD cop's training if the cop leaves the job and goes to their department.
Wow.
Yeah.
So how does this, short of a change in leadership in New York City, not just within the NYPD, but how does this turn around, John?
Well, it doesn't. You just nailed it. It has to be a change in leadership in New York City, because the police commissioner serves at the leisure of the mayor. And so it's always been, even under Rudy Giuliani and William Bratton, which was a highly effective partnership for a little while, Giuliani really set the policy. And Bratton, as great as he was back then, I'm a little disappointed in him now, he had to use his genius within the confines of the policy the mayor set. And that's just always the way it's been. These aren't elected sheriffs. So there has to be a change in the mayor's office to see any change in the NYPD.
All right. Now, outside of New York City, we again saw a violent weekend for law enforcement officers in Prince George's County, right outside of D.C. We had an officer who was murdered. Three brothers are being held. The Washington Post reporting that two of the brothers held a connection with the fatal shooting of Officer Ja'Kai Colson, filmed the attack on a police station using their cell phones. The third brother apparently died in the attack. Police say that the gunman intended to die in the attack. But, you know, this looks, John, I mean, this looks pretty likely to be, a target attack on law enforcement because they are law enforcement. An attempt to videotape this, to publicize this, to perhaps spur on copycat crimes.
Oh, absolutely. And this, and tragically, while the initial elements were a little bit different, this is very similar to what happened to police officer Daniel Hoffer in Euless, Texas. In both cases, an act was initiated to draw the police out, and it was a 911 call in Texas, and in this case, they fired rounds off outside of the police station to get police to the scene and then ambush them, open fire on them when they got there. So this was a planned ambush and attack, as was in Euless, Texas.
How concerned are the officers that you were talking to right now about these types of attacks? I mean, you know, we've been talking about this really, I think, ever since the protests in Ferguson, riots in Baltimore. We've had, people say, listen, we don't think that these attacks are on the upswing. We've had others who say, absolutely, they are. What are the officers that you talk to? What are they feeling right now?
That they're on the upswing. The latter of what you said, that now there's a new bold, brazen type of criminal that who have been emboldened by rhetoric from the Obama administration, by a very tepid response from the Department of Justice toward the protesters, toward the cop hate. One of the things cops always talk about is, look, our president went to Cuba and didn't demand the return of Joanne Chesimard, a convicted cop killer. From the top down, there's this apathy toward dead cops. And so police fear for their safety more now than I've seen in the last 20-plus years.
And as we're talking here, John, Paul Wagner at Fox 5 in D.C. says the Prince George's County Chief of Police is expected to announce that Officer Colson was killed by friendly fire in that attack.
Geez. Well, even worse. That's even more tragic because that means that there was just such chaos at the scene. But I haven't seen that report. But if that's the case, man, I mean, that's just what do you say to that?
Yeah,
it's absolutely tragic.
Well, and what I mean, I you know, at this point, what do you say to officers, John, when it seems like, you know, there was a story last week, I think the Washington Post reported on this, when it comes to mass shootings, does the media sort of inspire and create these copycat killers? And there's some evidence that, yes, in fact, media attention, media coverage of the perpetrators of these crimes can lead others to decide that they want to act. I worry that we're going to see the same thing and that we are seeing the same thing here, that, in fact, there's almost some sick game of one-upsmanship when it comes to attacks on our civil society and when it comes to attacks on our law enforcement.
Yeah, there is. Part of the problem, Cam, is that we look at things, when you and I talk and your audience listens, we're all looking at things through the lens of rational, law-abiding people, right? And criminals don't do that. A lot of street cred is gained if you try to kill a cop, and man, if you succeed in killing a cop. And in many of these neighborhoods, going to prison is a goal. It's not something they aspire not to be. It's something they aspire to be. Going to prison and running a gang in prison gives you a lot of credibility on the street. And so there are people that actually try to go to jail for the most egregious offense possible. So when they get there, they're a hero. They're a rock star. It's a warped mentality. But progressive politicians refuse to understand it. And until they do, we're going to be seeing dead cops and injured innocents.
So when Hillary Clinton was asked last night, what would you do to reduce gang violence? And she said, well, I'd pass some gun control laws.
Exactly.
Not where you would go then, John.
No. Absolutely not. I would go to the place you and I always speak about, profiling and targeting that 6 to 16% of a neighborhood we know are the violent offenders, the people committing crimes.
John Cardillo, a former New York police officer, host of the John Cardillo Show. Thank you, as always, sir, for coming to the program, and I hope we get a chance to do this again soon.
Anytime, Cam. Thanks a million.
You bet. John Cardillo with us here on NRA News, Cam and Company. Unfortunately, we are almost out of time here on this edition of the program, but we are going to be back with you tomorrow live, 2 p.m. Eastern, on NRANews.com, midnight Eastern, 9 Pacific, on Sirius XM Patriot 125. All the time available for you on demand on iHeartRadio and on iTunes. And don't forget the new NRA News Roku channel, where you can access not just NRA News Cam and Company, but all of the fantastic programming from NRA News. Coming up on the program tomorrow, I swear it just worked out this way. We're going to talk with John's producer, Bethany Bora, a conservative activist down in Florida on a primary day, plus Dan Bongino, writing at Conservative Review, and we'll also talk about the, oh, by the way, with Dan, we're going to talk about, this was also going to be one of the deals of the day, but I'm glad we're saving it till tomorrow. According to Immigration and Customs Enforcement, 124 illegal immigrants released from prison, later charged with 138 homicides. Mm-hmm. Here in the United States. Plus, our friend Julie Gunlock from the Independent Women's Forum will join us on tomorrow's program. We're going to be taking Julie and the women from the IWF to the NRA range later in the week. I'm looking forward to that. In the meantime, have yourself a fantastic rest of your Monday and your Tuesday until we talk again. Thanks for being a part of this edition of your first source for Second Amendment news and information, NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler.